Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Wellwithal. Wellwithal believes that self-care is community care. Premium products crafted for your daily wellness, from sleep support to heart health to your daily regimen. 20% of Wellwithal's profits are committed to leading the fight for health equity. They won't stop until it is truly Wellwithal. And Bunker Hill Community College, offering 6-week summer mini-sessions to help students achieve college and skills goals. Sessions start June 3rd and July 15th. Registration is open. bhcc.edu/summer.
Today on Boston Public Radio, there was a time when George H.W. Bush's legacy was reduced to his breaking his no-new-taxes promise. Today, he has a reputation of being a great public servant, a man of grace, a model of what the Republican Party used to stand for. On today's Politics Roundup, we look at his legacy, the good, the bad, think Clarence Thomas, and the ugly, does Willie Horton come to mind? Then Charlie Sennert is here for his take on the G20 and how Trump's presumably made peace with China on trade. At noon, we take your calls on President Bush's legacy.
Susan Norlean's latest book investigates the largest book burning in U.S. history, the fire at the Central Library in Los Angeles, which ruined a million books. And along the way, she pays tribute to an institution that is thriving despite the so-called threats of Amazon and the Internet. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Nice column, Marjorie. Do you want to tell people what it's about? It's great. We started the discussion. I want to give myself a little credit on the radio last week.
I stole the idea from you, Jim.
You did. Well, it wasn't from me. It was from us. But tell people what you wrote. It was pretty good.
It's about feeling guilty, you know, with all these terrible tech companies. I mean, every present I buy is from Amazon.com. I'm contributing to their horrible reputation. I'm, you know, running around doing it on my Apple computer, my Apple phone, my iPad at my side, and doing it via Facebook and Verizon phone. All these places are implicated in these terrible situations. And I'm complicit in the crimes.
Well, can I make you feel a little better? Mm-hmm. 6-year-olds got to work too. That's sure. The way I look at child labor.
I describe this to somebody as the ultimate Catholic guilt column this
morning. Exactly. That's right. The Catholic guilt column. But
I'll tell you who
feel
that voice
terrible
was in a second.
Because, you know, it's true.
Not terrible enough to do anything,
I mean,
of course.
What's my excuse? So, I don't want to drive to the mall. Is that my excuse?
Okay, fine. Now, the tributes to President George H.W. Bush, from his closest allies like Colin Powell, James Baker, to his former political foes like President Clinton and Governor Dukakis, are a testament to his legacy as a leader and as a man. To further underscore his broad appeal, even the people at SNL's Weekend Update were compelled to pay their respects.
Former President George H.W. Bush passed away. He was 94 years old. Our thoughts and condolences go out to his family and friends.
President Bush was famously a very warm and gracious man who always understood the power in being able to laugh at yourself.
Not gonna do it. Not gonna do it.
Damn. George Bush here. I'm watching you do your impression of me, and I gotta say, it's nothing like me. Bears no resemblance. It's bad.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I think it's a fair impression.
Don't see it.
You don't?
It's totally exaggerated. Not me, those crazy hand gestures, the pointing thing, I don't do them. And also, na-ga-da, never said it. In all my years of government service, I never once said na-ga-da.
Here was Studio 3 to take stock of his presidency, the good and the bad, and other politics headlines are Charlie Chippio. He's the principal of Chippio Strategy, senior fellow of both the Governing and Pioneer Institutes, and Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer, former Democratic nominee for governor, and I would argue today at least the second most famous athlete ever to graduate from Yale University. Shannon O'Brien, how are you?
I have a picture of me sitting on one of those fences.
Yes, I do.
So, Shannon O'Brien, you're a Democrat. You knew Michael Dukakis, ran against George H.W. Bush back in 88. Good things about Bush, some tough things about Bush, too.
I think that a lot of our sort of analysis around George Bush is in contrast to the current resident
exactly.
in the White House.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, one, you know, Corporal Bone Spurs versus a guy who was, you know, one of the youngest, you know, pilots during World War II. You know, a guy who was self-effacing, a guy who, you know, would reach out across the aisle, you know, on many occasions. A guy who just seemed like a very, very decent parent human being, you know, and Donald Trump, who, you know, appears to have, you know, a lot less qualities in that arena. You know, that being said, you know, I was reading on, you know, you look on Facebook and there are lots of, you know, a million different posts. And one of the most poignant ones I saw, you know, which talks about the conflicted, I think, record of President Bush was, you know, I have heard that George Bush has died today and I'm in deep mourning for the thousands of people who died of AIDS, you know, when his administration failed to address that issue during his administration. So I think he is someone who is a genuine hero, war hero, good person, great public servant to this country, but with a somewhat mixed record as president.
And by the way, at noon, for those who were saying, I want to get on this too, we're going to take your calls about George W. Bush. You know, one of the things, Charlie, I never understood is this whole tired thing, don't speak ill of the dead. I never understood why it's disrespectful when you celebrate the good that somebody like he did to talk about a Willie Horton or mm-hmm. his position on the Civil Rights Act when he's running for, I think, the Senate in the 60s.
Or Clarence Thomas.
Or Clarence Thomas. I mean, he, like every – and Dan Quayle, obviously. He, like everybody else, has a mixed record. Is that not a
– Well, that's right. I think all – what we owe the dead is to give a balanced recollection and balanced memory of them. And I think, you know, the great irony of George Bush is that here is someone who, by all accounts, was a truly, you know, kind and decent guy who is in many ways opened the door to the kind of toxic politics that we have
Lee
today.
Lee Atwater. And you don't see Lee Atwater's name in any of those obituaries. Right. At least I haven't.
You've seen him in some articles who we were, Charlie and I were talking off air, that, you know, he went on his own apology tour when he was
dying.
Specifically around the Willie Horton ads. So.
But see, I also think the point you made, and Adrian Walker makes a similar point in his column in the Globe today, is that the fact that we have to be praising a dead president and the first thing that comes out of our mouth is how civil he was is pathetic. I don't mean pathetic that we're praising George Bush, but you're right. It's totally because everything, whether it's conscious or otherwise, is in comparison to 45 as compared to 41. You know, one of the things I find amazing, we all know that the Bush family did not want Trump at the Barbara Bush thing. The John McCain family did not want him there. He is not only did he disparage the children, one a president, one a governor. Just not more than a few months ago, he was making fun of 1,000 Points of Light in the most
more recently disparate, than that.
Was it? What it was,
and then he refers to it in his statement. Is this very nice statement that somebody wrote for him about Bush's dying? Talks about 1,000 Points of Light.
So how does that go on? What is it, Thursday? I'm not even sure what day the National Cathedral thing is. Later this week, whatever it is. Obviously, lying in state. How does that? Does Trump? Do we know? Is Trump speaking at this?
I don't know
thing,
if he's speaking. He's going.
No, I think Pence will be eulogizing him, but I do not
I didn't
think
know that.
That Trump. I just heard something on this station.
Pence?
I think so. I think Pence is going to be speaking at some point. I don't know whether it is in maybe in you know, the halls of Congress. I don't. He's lying in state in the Capitol building. So I think that there's something there. But I did hear some snippet.
God, I hope it's not Pence. That would be very disappointing.
You know who deserves praise in this thing, too? Marjorie and I were talking about before. Is Governor Dukakis, getting back to honesty about this, who obviously was the victim of like this Horton thing, even though Dukakis regularly says it's his own fault that he didn't fight back harder. Here's the quote to the Associated Press. Obviously, we disagreed pretty strongly on domestic policy. I wasn't thrilled with the kind of campaign he ran, but I think his greatest contribution was in negotiating the end of the Cold War with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. It's a totally honest, balanced thing from a guy who, you know, if I had been on the other end of Willie Horton, I'm not so sure I'd be so generous.
Well, and we
even
just
30 years later.
We just listened to Saturday Night Live, and one of my favorites is John Lovitz as Michael Dukakis.
Oh, God.
And looking on and in his head going, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that they're both, you know, both Bush and Dukakis have a sort of sense of class that is lacking right now.
By the way, if people miss the classic, it's online. I'm so
it's
glad
great.
You brought it up.
Yeah.
With Lovitz, a question is asked of George Bush, Dan Carvey, and George Bush has no, I mean, just his answer is so ridiculous and out there, and that's the moment at which the balloon over his head.
The balloon over his head, you can hear him speaking.
And I'm losing to this guy, right?
And then before John Lovitz talks, there's the riser.
That goes up, right. That's right.
I forgot about that. You know, it was very interesting, though. He was interviewed by one of his granddaughters, Jenna Bush.
Jenna Bush is on NBC now.
Yeah, did you see that interview?
I heard part of it on TV.
It was interesting. She was at interviewing him up at Kennebunkport, which if people haven't seen it, the Globe had a beautiful picture of it yesterday, this whole peninsula out there in the middle of the ocean. Anyway, she says to him, what's your legacy or something? He says, well, he doesn't like the L word, the legacy word. But he said... something like, I'll be remembered for the things I did wrong and will be remembered for what we did right. So it was what I did wrong, what we did right. And that was another contrast that he would say they were my mistakes and we did the right things together.
Mm. You know what you always said, but I don't know, I assumed we'd get to this at noon, but it just hit my head. When we've talked about H.W. Bush, 41, in the past, you and I, Marjorie, on the air, you often mention how he is the rare politician who suffered horrible misfortune in his family when his daughter died, who did not exploit the family tragedy for I for years and years didn't even know that he had a daughter.
It was Robin.
We didn't know it too much. Well, I think that was kind of one of the WASPy kind of things. You know, you don't talk about how great you are. You don't exploit the family tragedies. The old Yankee kind of thing, and they were.
But ultimately, I think the one thing that I take away from him, and you can look at a sort of mixed record. Certainly some great successes, but in going along with the tax increase, to allow the country to, avoid some really devastating choices and then suffering the political consequences.
And knowing at the time when he did it that he was going to suffer
consequences. So at the same time, I think someone wrote, him, what he did to run and some of the sort of choices that he made, when he was on his way out the door pardoning, people from Iran-Contra, but that there still was that sort of sense of duty. And that's the one thing I will say probably best defines him for me is a sense of duty, not only volunteering for World War II, but a sense of duty, understanding that at some point in time, although he was getting outvoted, by both the House and the Senate, but a sense of duty to doing the right thing for the country at that point. I still believe he has a very mixed record, but there is that sense of duty and that sense of public service and that sense of beyond me that I do think is, a trend in his history.
Which you criticize fellow Republicans, and particularly in the Senate, for failing to embrace virtually every single day on the show.
Oh, my gosh.
No, but I mean, it stands out even more again because of a comparison, I would argue. We're turning to Charlie Chippio and Shannon O'Brien.
Let's move on to the Mueller investigation, which we've been hearing so much about in recent days. The New York Times had a great story yesterday. And pointing out that everybody, including the president and everyone who surrounds him, are a bunch of liars. President lies all the time. Paul Manafort lies all the time. Michael Cohen lies all the time. Michael Flynn was lying. Papadopoulos, if that's how you pronounce his name.
That's how you say it,
He was lying. Corsi's lying. Stone's lying. Don Jr.'s lying. So it was sort
of... By the way, did you see the tweet that Trump put out this morning about Mueller? Yeah. Quote, they're all lying. And don't you think that's in reaction, I think, in reaction to the New York Times piece? But I'm sorry.
I mean, there's a lot of question about whether any of this will even the worst stuff will hurt the president. I think it will, but many people think it won't. But in any case, that is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, like the liar's game or something.
What do you mean, the liar's
game?
That
he's surrounded, as the New York Times says, everywhere you look.
Well, I mean, this is a guy who says, I hire the best people, and then every one of them ends up being a liar, being a bad person. You know, if they turn on him, then they're bad people. And this is the same guy who said, I only hire the best, most talented people around me until they say bad things about him,
but
and then they're terrible
I think
and
that
weak.
His definition of the best people is probably different from yours and mine. I mean, his only measure is how they serve his interests.
Right. Which is frightening.
Because Michael Cohen's now weak and he was never able to. You know, one of the interesting things that we've discussed this ad nauseum.
I saw his title. He was vice president of the Trump administration. I didn't know he held that title.
Not of Trump Corporation.
Trump Corporation. But I was stunned when I saw that. I didn't know he held such a title other than sort of nebulous attorney.
Fixer kind of thing.
Other thing that people always say, all politicians lie. We get a lot of that in the email, but I think, all politicians do lie, but this is a whole
this is a different
new
level. Lying.
I mean, you used to be a Republican. What do you think about this, Charlie Chippio?
You used to be a liar when you were younger, Charlie. Do you remember back?
It is kind of extraordinary.
Well, I would first say the only time in my life that I was Republican was when I registered as Republican in 1980 to vote for John Anderson.
Ah.
So, but
you weren't a Republican when you worked for Romney?
No.
You weren't? Oh, really?
Enrolled. Yeah.
Good for him.
But anyway, the party doesn't even matter. I mean, this is just appalling. And what's more appalling to me is the fact that the one thing that it seems that he said that President Trump has said that isn't a lie was when he got up there a couple of years ago and said that he could walk out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and he still wouldn't lose any supporters. So it is very strange. And I think what's going on now with the Mueller, with the Mueller investigation, well, you know, it'll hurt him a little bit. But as of now, I rarely put on the lawyer hat, thankfully. But I don't see anything that's been shown yet that would be, you know, would be illegal. Maybe there will be. There's a very good chance that there will be. But, you know, it's just stuff that's
immoral. Still running his business during the campaign?
Yeah. I mean, it's immoral and it's something that.
Well, I have to say, I think we have no idea what Mueller's got. Well, I mean, we're getting a clearer sense. We don't know how far it goes.
Right.
But I have to say,
Tax evasion.
We already know there's tax evasion. You read the New York Times. I think the big issue for America, which really transcends, in my estimation, the presidency of Donald Trump, is whether it will matter. I mean, Mueller can do a bill of particulars, and let's assume that Matt Whitaker, is that his name? Whitaker allows, and that's a whole other issue. Read Michael Cohen, I think his name is, who's the most liberal columnist of the Globe, writes a piece of essentially saying, can you believe the Attorney General of the United States is this guy? Which is really true. But what I started to say was I think they've done a brilliant job. Rudy Giuliani in the last 24 hours, how unethical the Mueller people are. Trump tweeting almost every single morning about it. I think they've and the Republicans so scared to even say that some of these issues raise doubts for them. I can see a situation where Mueller comes out with an incredibly carefully researched bill of particulars, including crimes about his kids, his associates, etc., in which virtually nothing changes in American politics.
I don't know why you keep saying this after the election we just had.
How many Republicans, name the Republicans who are running for re-election, who after Michael Cohen's plea the other day said, this is really concerning to me?
Well, what we had in this last election was a lot of suburban Republicans who had voted for Donald Trump, and not voting for him, voting for Democrats this time.
You didn't answer my question. How many Republicans in Congress have stood up and said, I'm a big supporter of the president's policies, but this is a bridge too far if Cohen's telling the truth?
But they're not the ones who are going to determine the vote in 2020.
There's an article in the Globe today that talks about how the Republicans, generally when you lose, you go and have some retreat in Maryland or Virginia, and you sort of, you know, in a private setting, you make a determination. How did we mess up here?
Obama and the younger Bush themselves admitted the night of the midterms that they
had been. And the article in the Globe says that they are not even doing that because they know what the elephant, no pun intended, in the room is.
See, that's
and they
my
don't
want to.
They don't want to take that on.
I do think. Look. I think at some point there's going to be a tipping point here. I don't know when it's going to come, but I do think that we've certainly seen that the American people have some limited patience with what's going on here. And look, I think that undoubtedly, as I look at it, I think the greatest story thus far of this administration is going to be the fact that the entire Republican Party stood by complicit and allowed all this to happen. But if he continues, if his ratings continue to fall, I got to think that Republicans, not out of any great morality or anything, are going to turn around and.
But ultimately, those policies start impacting people,
right.
And so all of a sudden, there's no more trade war with China. I mean, it was sort of like they went through this whole weekend, you know, of meeting. You know, we are one out of 20 of the G20 nations that is not in favor of the Paris Climate Accord. Yeah. That's like small potatoes.
Not at this Polish summit that's happening now.
Right. But the fact that they completely changed their position on the tariffs, you know, as farmers, as other people in the heartland and auto manufacturers, you're starting to see what the damage his actual policies will do. That has never really had a chance to roll out. So one is sort of the writ large, the embarrassment of what's going on. But what happens when those policies actually are implemented?
By the way, if you want to have fun and you're not on Twitter, just Google Paul Ryan saying in an interview, history is going to be very good to this majority. And look at all the responses from virtually everybody on the planet.
Is he just totally delusional?
I have no idea. I'm
sorry,
Charlie.
I have some respect for him, but I...
Okay, we're going to wrap this up and get to the local headlines because there's a lot of good ones. We're going over those headlines with Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien, local and state politics, when we return with them up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics now on the local variety with Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien.
I love talking about transportation with Charlie Chipio, who's obsessed with transportation, as I am. So ridership of the T is going way down, Charlie, except for the Blue Line.
Except for the Blue Line.
Yeah. What's up with that?
Well, I think a few things. One, the Blue Line has the best on-time record. There's a bunch of housing development going on along the way there that the Blue Line covers. And I think the other thing is just that there's room and on the Blue Line for more. The Blue Line is less crowded than the other lines. It's got a third of the riders as the Orange Line and the Green Line. It's got a quarter of the riders as the Red Line. So it works. There's more housing along the way, and there's room for more people to get on without having to risk their health.
But isn't it a problem? And forget the Blue Line. The fact that we can't drive anywhere anymore. The fact that there are fewer. I mean, the goal is to drive more people. I don't mean it as a pun.
Yeah.
To put more people on mass transit, not fewer. Is there a strategy on Beacon Hill? What is it?
Well, I think there
not
is.
Not your strategy. What is the Beacon? Well, maybe it's the same. What is the Beacon Hill strategy?
I mean, the strategy is that what we're seeing is these big investments that are going into the central subway system, which is where it should be, because you have to realize we've had 25 years of investment largely in the commuter rail. And, you know, we've got the new Orange Line.
The commuter rail's doing great, so it's really paid off by the entire thing.
Well, that's the problem. They didn't fix anything. They just built new lines. But you got the Red Line cars, the Orange Line cars, the fare collection. You know, you're going to be able to see a dramatic increase in the capacity of the central.
Well, the capacity is going to go up. But I mean, when we read that, the most startling story on the transportation front last year to me, because I assumed it was a typo, was that story in the Globe. There were 100,000 Uber and Lyft rides per day in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Well, people are taking Uber Pool because it's cheaper for them to take Uber Pool and have three or four people in the Uber
than to get to work faster.
Okay, Shannon O'Brien, this is my favorite lead of like ages. This is talking about the commuter rail by Adam Vaccaro and John Elliman and Stephen Neer in the Globe. On Tuesday, a wheel came off. On Thursday, it was a fire. It's been a very rough few weeks on the commuter rail, highlighted by a derailment on the Waltham-Belmont border and an engine fire in Hanson. On Thursday afternoon, State Transportation Secretary Pollack criticized recent service as unacceptable.
But not Keolis, I thought, which was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things, as someone who obviously was a constitutional officer and you ran for governor and that sort of thing, I mean, obviously, since... To Baker's credit, he has said, I own transportation. He hasn't said it maybe in so many words, but he has not played games and said, oh, this is, Deval Patrick's fault or whatever. This is mine, essentially, the Financial Control Board and all that sort of thing. And people seem to accept it overwhelmingly because he crushed his opponent. How much tolerance? We have riots in Paris for days now over fuel prices. We read stories about the T and the commuter rail almost every day, and I'm amazed how willing to take it average people seem to be. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I don't think you're going to see them lighting, you know.
No, I'm not suggesting like cars on fire.
I'm not the South End, but I do think that people maybe I don't know. Would that make you happy?
No, I just don't know. Be happy. Really, I'm just asking.
But I think that Marjorie and I. This has been an issue for me. You know, that transportation. You know, when I ran for governor in 2002, and it's how many years later. But this is something that I now think that people. You know, my husband commutes in and out every day, and it impacts
former his, state rep
former
too,
state
by
rep,
the way, yes.
Who, by the way, was the guy who helped bring the Kingston Rail down to the South Shore. That was his legislative and, you know, sort of moral, you know, follow-up. But the problem, I think that people are concerned about it right now. I think that when you're polling, I think that people are looking at this. And I think that now that Charlie Baker, I'm hoping now that Charlie Baker is in his second term, that this becomes, you know, I know that opioids is something that he talks about a lot and has been working to make a dent in. But this state doesn't survive as an economy. You know, the economic inequality, the ability for people, I don't want to go into Boston anymore. You know, I was, again, Charlie and I were talking offline, just like little things, like I want to take the red line in. So I drive my car to Braintree. I look at the app first and it says 22 spaces at Braintree. Yay, I can take the subway in. No, I can't because they're all handicapped spaces. So there's like little things that they can fix, but the big things that they can fix. I believe that Keolis needs to be held accountable. You know, we also were talking that when they won this contract, they underbid by hundreds of millions of dollars. But there were many people critical at that point in time who said they can't do it for that much
and
less.
They were right.
They were right.
And they're getting extra money to
now
fill the hole.
Now they're getting extra money, yeah.
So, Charlie, why was Stephanie Pollack's a really smart person? She's Secretary of Transportation.
She says things are unacceptable, Jim.
No, but why was, I mean, smart enough and then some that if she intended to call out Keolis, she would have called out Keolis. Why was Keolis not mentioned the other day in this? What should we take away from that?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I would be willing to bet all of my meager possessions that in 2022 we're going to be saying goodbye to Keolis.
When the contract is up?
Yes. When this contract is up, I think Keolis has proved their inability to handle this contract. And so, you know, why she would not say that, you know, I don't know.
Well, that's a whole second term. I can do the math and you can too.
Yeah.
That's Baker's whole second term with Keolis running commuter rail. So what is that? You seem to be approving of their plan. Gonzalez said during the campaign, you know, the 15 years to get to whatever that state of repair thing is. If what's the one thing you think Baker is not doing that with all this political capital and a second term he should be?
Well, yes. I here's what I would say. First of all, I would say if they can do this get rid of this backlog in 15 years, it would be a miracle because it's $7.3 billion without without even including the commuter rail.
This is just the repair backlog.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So I mean, like so much of what Jay Gonzalez said, it's just crazy to think that you're going to do that faster than in 15 years. But the thing, the big issue, this is obviously from a policy point of view and not from a political point of view, is that you have a situation right now where around the country, commuter rail systems are lines are shutting down because of the and instead of running lines and running sort of far-flung service, they're subsidizing Uber and Lyft. Once we have autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, shared electric vehicles, I find it very hard to believe that that commuter rail, for the most part, is going to be able to compete. And so I think the question becomes, how do you sort of keep this going?
So not
going
to be fresh. This is almost like your Jetsons prediction, right?
Well, this is within the next 20 years. It's within the next 20 years.
But the traffic.
But the autonomous vehicles are going to have double and triple the throughput. There's not going to need to
What's
be any
throughput?
Space.
Not
how
one
many cars
person.
Can get. You can have twice as many cars on the same road in the same time period.
Why? Because they drive better?
Because they're controlled by computers and they need, you know, an inch between each other.
So you can
and
do
they're
going
to be able to go much faster.
So as opposed to me getting ticked off at the woman putting her mascara on in the car next to me.
That was me.
Which also...
That's right. You're going to have cars going 100 miles
Talk
an hour.
Talk about Catholic guilt.
You know, an inch apart. And so, and once they're shared vehicles as well, and the fact that more than half of the cost of vehicles today is the driver... They're not, you know, public transit is not going to have a price a price advantage anymore. Mm-hmm. So what you got to do?
So can I translate this a little bit? So what you're basically saying, if I can put it in English, is we are totally doomed. Is that what you're saying?
No, we're not doomed.
20 years.
Charlie,
who's talking?
No,
Charlie.
Well, because you didn't let me finish.
Oh, sorry.
What we need to do is we need to figure out something to sort of get this through the
what
next
is it?
20 years.
What is it?
Well, it's putting a lot of money into maintenance, but not building a lot of new
no,
bricks
new
and
lines.
Mortar that yeah, are just going to be obsolete by the time.
But Charlie, I don't understand how. I know you said that you could have more cars on the road and stuff like that, but the T does take a lot of people off the road, and a lot of people in Boston don't have cars. And even if they did get involved with the autonomous cars,
when you have transportation as a service as opposed to control having your own vehicle, and that service is not any more expensive than the T.
Right.
This is really going to democratize transportation.
I think he's also what he's saying is also rather than that one person putting her eye makeup on, you know, there will be four people in a car and three people in a car putting their eye makeup on and not creating. And
you so are you saying we won't need the T or commuter rail?
I'm saying – no, I'm not saying we won't need the T. I'm saying particularly commuter rail,
okay.
These more far-flung services are going to find it very hard to compete.
So downtown – so what it is how we get people in will be more efficient in the future from outside. And then once you're in,
what we really need to focus on is making short trips in the city – convenient and cost efficient by transit, because that's where the congestion will be horrible.
This week we'll talk about getting into the city, and next time you're here we'll talk about getting out of the city once you're in the city. Before you guys leave, I don't know if this is one of the reasons you and I got in a fight many years ago. I can't remember what it was. You and I, Shannon, and we don't have to revisit. I shouldn't have brought that up. But in any case, I am one who believes it'd really be healthy for Massachusetts if there were two parties, which there are not. I mean, despite the fact we have Republican governors a lot, it'd be nice to me if it wasn't like 10 to 1 or whatever the thing is in the legislature. Kirsten Hughes, who's been the head of the Republican Party in the state for 6 years, is leaving. She's leaving after an election in which every single office, every single constitutional office, every single congressional office was won by a Democrat, except for obviously Governor Baker and Karen Pulido as lieutenant governor. I think I read that they lost three legislative seats, which they almost had none to begin with. If you had to give advice, I know you're a Democrat, both of you, before we leave, the only thing I can think of is I was going to say it needs more involvement from the Republican governor who's wildly popular. But I remember the guy who you ran against, Mitt Romney. Didn't he run 101 Republicans 1 year? And I think 101 out of 101 lost or some such thing.
Yeah.
What's the cure to bring, if you whether you believe it or not, how do you bring more balance between Democrats and Republicans in Massachusetts? What's the key?
Well, I'd argue that because we do have, you know, quite often Republican governors that provide, you know, at least in theory, that balance, you know, there is a sort of type of balance here in Massachusetts that may or may not be good for the state. I think that the Republican Party, you know, just like the Democratic Party, there is no party. You know, it's sort of what suit do you
That's
put on when you
yeah.
when you run? And there is the gamut between really conservative, you know, Democrats, you know, and socialists coming in, you know, to the Massachusetts Party. I think the most important thing right now and why Charlie Baker does need to get involved is in my hometown, it was Scott Lively Central, the very, very right-wing, anti-gay, you know, very religious, you know, Republican. I think it's really important for Charlie Baker to make sure that the Republican Party remains in the image of Charlie Baker, Frank Sargent, Bill Weld. And then you become, then you are attractive alternatives, even on the local level, to Democrats. But I don't see that is where the party is going.
We only have a minute, Charlie. How about
you? I think this whole Kirsten Hughes thing is terrifying, and I've never met Kirsten
Wait,
Hughes in my
terrifying?
Life. The fact that she's leaving, because what really terrifies me is one statistic that I think is amazing. On a percentage basis, Charlie Baker beat Gonzalez by more than he beat Scott Lively, who obviously is a crazy person. Mm-hmm. And so the degree to which something I never thought I would see happen in my life, that the Massachusetts Republican Party is being taken over by the Deals and the Trumpkins and all that kind of stuff, is really troubling.
And if they are taken by those people, I think they're going to have a harder time in this state maintaining political power base.
Thank you both.
Thank you
nice
very
to
much.
See you both.
Charlie Chipio is principal of Chipio Strategies and senior fellow at both the Governing and Pioneer Institutes, and Shannon O'Brien is former state treasurer and Democratic nominee for governor. Charlie and Shannon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Charlie Sennett joins us for his take on the G20 and a bunch of other stuff next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. President George H.W. Bush's foreign policy is defined by closing one chapter with his role in helping end the Cold War and opening a new one in the Middle East with our involvement in the Gulf War, which started America's direct and far-reaching involvement in the region. Joining us in Studio 3 for his take on this and other global headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hey there, Charlie Sennett.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Charlie Sennett. Well, let's start with the G20. A truce, at least temporary, between us and China. This is a good thing, or what's the deal?
It's a good thing. It's definitely a good thing. It's certainly well packaged once again by our president. I don't know that it's substantive, but it's much better messaging. But I just want to pause for 1 minute at the G20 and say the setting is just so perfect. To be in Argentina, you can hear the tango music as Trump is moving through that room, trying to delicately choreograph. How is he going to deal with Putin, given all of the news leading into this?
Yeah.
How is he going to deal with the crown prince of Saudi Arabia?
By the way, before you even continue, the most disgusting video that I have seen in a long time was the high five between Putin and the crown prince when they sat down. As nauseating and
giggling.
Only nauseating, considering what they both do for a living, but that they're two people who
Donald Trump's dear friends. Kim Jong-un was there. They could have all had a big
huddle. But I interrupted you. Go ahead. Everybody's seen the video.
You got it. That's exactly it. And did you see Saturday Night Live?
I didn't. Really, we heard part of it a few minutes ago.
Okay, it was very
good. With the high five?
Yeah, they had Putin and the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, come out and do this whole thing about, you know, and it was sort of like Putin was jilting the Donald in favor of the government. And so, it was just so perfect. And I do think it's such a dramatic place, Argentina, to have this meeting, because what's happening is really about this dance. And it's a very, very delicate dance. And there's no more.
We're talking China now or Russia?
We're talking about Russia, but we're also just talking about the world assembled at the G20 and Donald Trump's role in the world. And nothing is more important than the global economy, which is reacting incredibly favorably just to a 90-day delay on whether or not we will indeed have a trade war with China. Because if we have a trade war with China, we already saw signs that the economy was starting to really show its own vote against that. But overnight, I haven't seen the latest, but the stock market opened going gangbusters, right? Is it still going?
And also that there was some sense that in the last election, the midterms, obviously, that the Midwest was turning somewhat against the president because of these tariffs.
The jobs, Ohio.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, look, this is big, but once again,
it's up 156 points as of 11:40 in the morning.
Okay,
go ahead.
That's good. So the thing is that no one is going to win in a trade war. And the question is this Trump at his best, where he is really good at this posturing and this sort of idea of bringing the apprentice to foreign diplomacy? And trying to really say, this is about business deals, and this is about America getting a better deal. There's no one I know who wouldn't want that, right? China has had practices, including ripping off our technology through the tech transfers, theft of intellectual property, and they have a terrible human rights record, and they get away with all this stuff. And I think everyone feels the need to want to do that. The question is this going to be a masterful stroke by Trump, or just more PR for something he didn't really do or change or do anything to impact other than try to put his Trump brand on what already existed? And that's to be determined over the next 90 days. But it's a big question. It pushes us into March. I think it allows the year to finish out. And I think the whole world knows, that entire summit at G20 knows, who knows what Donald Trump's status will be as a president in March.
You know, can we stay on this just for 1 minute? I think it was on NPR this morning. I was, you know, reading Donald Trump using his favorite word, amazing, to describe the interim deal he struck with Xi and with the president of China at that dinner. But only one report I heard, which was on NPR, and then I saw one line in The Guardian, is that what's not in the United States summary of what they agreed to at dinner, but is in the Chinese summary, is an acknowledgement of this one China thing. Which is a really big deal, I should say. But the fact that it's buried almost everywhere suggests, is China making this up, or what do you think of this?
Look,
explain the issue, if you will.
Sure. Well, so Taiwan considers itself an independent state. China considers it part of one China. It's been a tension point for a long time. Anyone who's ever written a word about Taiwan, if you describe it as part of China, the Taiwanese consulate here in Boston or the embassy will call and say, that's wrong and you can't do that. And there's a there's an understandable tension between the Taiwanese and the Chinese over the status of that place. And it's dearly important to them. We don't follow it very closely, but Trump just sort of glazes over this and acts like he's not even hearing. He's tone deaf to the intensity of that diplomatic piece of the landscape that he's basically saying, oh, well, yeah, they're calling it one China. Well, that's really big. And that would change U.S. foreign policy in relation to that issue. And so that's the kind
wasn't
of thing
the,
that's not
did,
in there.
Did I not remember that shortly after Trump either became president or was sworn in, didn't he make a call to the leader of Taiwan?
Yeah,
wasn't
that's
that his,
right.
first,
his
call
first call
or one of his
that's
first
right. To assure them. So it's the inconsistency of Trump. It's his sense that the grand gesture and the theater that it creates is more important than the specific policies. And what really caught my eye as well, Jim, was just this the language that was used, where you had the Chinese media referencing about, you know, basically that there's this big 90-day condition, and it's really downplayed. As far as what their side gets, right? So they're basically saying, China is basically putting out the word through its state-run media, we won this. We got it. We've taken care of a lot of things, including one China. And it sort of downplays this idea that, and we'll work with them on forced technology transfers. But the U.S. Press release that comes out talks about how they're basically saying this is a done deal, that they will indeed make these steps to correct this issue of tech transfers. And it's basically, in other words, you have the Trump branding exercise on what happened, and then you have China messaging it a completely different way through its state-run media, which, just to reflect back, it was also something, wasn't it Trump who said how much he loved how China controls its media? And that he wishes he had that.
Well, there's been some talk lately in the administration
with one,
Bob Thompson about a Trump news State network to compete with the international CNN. Well, that's a very good point. But it's not worldwide, unlike
it's
CNN,
worldwide.
Which has trouble. We're talking to Charlie Sennett.
So, Charlie Sennett, the president canceled this meeting with Putin, and he said it was because Putin refused to return these 24 Ukrainian sailors and naval vessels that were seized by the Russians. Now, people are skeptical about that.
Well, the question is, did it have anything to do with the news that broke that you may have offered Putin a $50 million penthouse apartment when you told in June of 2016 when you were telling everyone in your party that you have nothing to do with Russia?
Hold on for a second. I've never been to Moscow. Have you been to Moscow?
I was kind of
surprised. I mean, I know real estate prices are high.
Ask Alex Beam when he's here. He was living there for years.
$50 million seems a lot of money for a penthouse in Russia, but maybe they'd have special things.
Moscow is among the most expensive real estate
in
the world.
Okay.
Often surpasses Paris.
Oh, it does. So maybe it would have been a bargain.
It's actually only a studio
bargain,
actually.
Over at One Dalton, we could get maybe slightly better price.
Okay.
No, but I think what was important here was that he's trying to play it off as if it's this moral stand he's suddenly willing to take.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And we're suspicious.
And everyone sees through it. The whole world sees through it. The thing about the G20 was this is a place where normally the United States goes to the G20 and it really goes there holding its head high, pulling the world together under a set of agreements.
It was 19-1 on climate change, and we were the one, by the way.
I know. It's so after the fires
depressing.
In California.
So,
oh, God.
And did you see the New York Times story on the Arctic and how fast are moving into the Arctic right now? It's front page story of the New York Times, really powerful reporting. But this just to set that stage, G20, okay, cue the tango music again. You've got all this movement on the stage, and you've got a president who not only does he undercut the international order that the United States has created and thrived in for the last 70 years, he doesn't understand it. I truly have come to realize that this is a president who doesn't understand the importance of these organizations in the health of the global economy and in the build of our own economy. And all of this, again, tango music, bring it up just a little bit right here, is set against the death of George H.W. Bush, who not only understood that international order and respected it and that it really shaped his foreign policy. He also fought for it, you know, as a young man who could have gone off to Yale, son of privilege. He goes to war. He's shot down in the Pacific. He's heroic. And he fought for that order and then worked his whole life as the head of the CIA, as the ambassador to China, as the president of the United States. He worked his whole life to uphold that order, and he is now being remembered for it. And I know I'm not alone, and everyone's probably seen a little too much of this analysis, but it is so stark to think of President Trump at the G20 as we bury this great president, George H.W. Bush.
How do you rate the George H.W. Bush's foreign policy record as well? People like Barack Obama say his management, for lack of a better, I think that was the word he used, of the, it was more artful than that, actually, of the Cold War, the post-wall coming down thing was brilliant. But I have to say, I read more things. This is surely not my area of expertise. I know that will surprise no one. I read a decent amount of criticism about the Gulf War and deciding not to take out Saddam at the time than I thought I would. So where are you, considering you spent your life foreign policy?
Do you remember the war? Do you remember when there was the Saturday Night Live guy who used to imitate George H.W. Bush, and he'd always say,
Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey. Yeah, sure.
Would not be prudent.
Wouldn't be prudent.
Wouldn't
right.
be prudent.
George H.W. Bush's foreign policy was prudent. He was steady. He operated by a set of rules that really kept the world order going. He held fast onto them. He believed in them. And he believed that when he said this aggression will not stand, he was within the UN Charter, Article 7, to tell Iraq it needs to get out of Kuwait, and it had the full force of Article 7. We came in with our allies and forced them out and did what we said we were going to do and called it a day.
Yeah.
Because he believed in that order. To have gone further would have gone past the UN mandate and would have not been within that order. So I think he made in history and in hindsight, some might argue he made a mistake. I'd argue he just went back to containment. He just put Saddam back in his corner and worked on containment. You know, mixed review on that one for sure, but the way he negotiated the end of the Cold War, the way he fought alongside President Reagan to work to be tough with the Soviet Union, then to be conciliatory with Gorbachev, and then to have really the perfect president, George H.W. Bush, to execute the end of the Cold War and the transition to a new relationship.
Well, I heard somebody say over the weekend, or I read it, I forget now, that H.W. Bush didn't spike the ball in the end zone of the Cold War.
Too,
and it was a great line saying there was no rubbing Gorbachev's face in this or anything like that.
He was a gentleman.
Like
you see those old photographs of him as the captain of the Yale baseball team, and you just know this was a guy who played by the rules, and
he was
fair.
Also, I mean, this is not my area of expertise either, but needless to say, when we got rid of Saddam Hussein, we lost all these Americans. All these Iraqis were killed. I mean,
well, remember, it was his son, George W. Bush, who said, we are going to go into Iraq. And believe me, I can tell you the way Middle East viewed that. And I'm always stunned that Americans don't get this.
Which, the younger Bush or the
older
Bush?
Here's how the Middle East viewed our foreign policy in Iraq. A father came along and didn't finish off the guy. And now our bad guy, Saddam Hussein, who represents us, is being challenged by the son. And we're going to fight like hell against this tribe.
By the way, I'm not from the Middle East. That's exactly what I thought was going on. Well,
that movie was all about how George was thought to be kind of the loser alcoholic running around partying.
George the younger, obviously.
Yeah, and Jeb was supposed to be the president, and that was all about getting daddy to love him more. But
exactly.
I don't know if that's true.
No, but in the Middle East, this was a tribal affair.
Yeah.
And the tribe was the Bush family. I think it's very interesting, and there's a lot of history there. But it was the miscalculation of Dick Cheney, who convinced
movie coming
movie.
Out about him.
I was just
I'm so excited. And the Roger Ailes movies this week too.
It was George W. Bush who executed what will go down in history as a terribly flawed foreign policy that resulted in a war that has still not really ended, and just hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives, civilian and military, thousands of American military personnel who have been killed there, journalists who have been killed covering this war. This is a a catastrophe and a disaster of a foreign policy. But that's on that sin falls upon the son, not the father.
You know, Charlie Sennett, we only have 2 minutes left. I don't want this to fall through the cracks because I worry that it's falling through the cracks in terms of our attention. Is whether there is ever, I hate the word justice for the words, so I can't believe I was about to use it, but I'll say it, that there's ever accountability for the murder of Khashoggi, who, for those who haven't listened, you knew and had met with on a number of occasions. Donald Trump says, I'm with Saudi Arabia. So is that the end of this? Or
I don't think
so. We saw a bunch of Republicans in the Senate actually standing up. Mm-hmm. Last week they were upset because Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, mm-hmm. didn't come mm-hmm. to tell her what her assessment was. They apparently are upset that the president is clearing the mm-hmm. crown prince because of business deals or jobs or something. Is something positive going to come out of this on our part, the United States part?
There was an article in the further reaches of the New York Times about the CIA's definitive report that really states that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, was directly in touch with this guy, Khatami, who they believe really ordered and executed the hit. And the 11 phone calls, this is about direct connection, what they call the smoking gun. And I don't think it's going away anytime soon, and here's why. The House of Saud wants it to go away. But the truth is,
so does the president.
And the president wants it to go away. And we'll find out if we ever get those tax returns, how much money he got from Saudi Arabia. But we also just have to presume right now, just look at it in terms of foreign policy. President Trump has built a foreign policy around Saudi Arabia right at the middle against Iran. Everything else is viewed as a proxy war for that. They're pivotal to our foreign policy. And Turkey's never going to let this go away. Iran's never going to let this go away. And the region will remember it's a time that the House of Saud is now weak. And this weakens the crown prince in deep and important ways that will impact and potentially change the Trump administration's foreign policy in the Middle East.
Well, again, and it's the only issue I can think of. There were a significant chunk of Republicans in the Senate have stood up for the right cause, and maybe that will force the issue, too.
Okay, we don't have time to talk about this today because we're out of time.
What?
But
Next time, what do we got?
The French. They take the streets. They riot at every infraction.
All right, in 30 seconds, here's how I would look at that.
Yep.
That is Bernie and Trump supporters coming together in one big street riot from the rural America that's all ticked off, whether you're left or right.
That's what was happening in New Hampshire during the primary. We were there for
them,
2 years ago.
Unlike us, where everything just rolls us over and they go out there and they say nothing.
Definitely. Next week, let's talk about it.
The difference between us and the French. Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie, thank you very much. Up next, we are opening the lines and asking you about George H.W. Bush, your commendations, your criticisms, everything in between. Listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, we open the lines and ask you about George H.W. Bush, from the best that he had to offer as a war hero and a public servant to the darker side of his legacy with bringing Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court and stoking racism in his presidential campaign in 1988. Then we look at a new work of nonfiction that investigates an arsonist, pays tribute to librarians with some history of Los Angeles along the way, and only writer Susan Orlean could tell it. She joins us to talk about her latest book.
From there, it's time for All Revved Up. We look at President George H.W. Bush's faith and how he brought evangelism to the Republican Party. Then we remember the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants with TV authority Bob Thompson. And poet Richard Blanco remembers his dearly departed dog on this week's edition of Village Voice. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Houston, Friday. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, hour number two. Hello again, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie. So we'll open up the lines right away and take your calls on what President George H.W. Bush means to you. We welcome your tributes, your dissent. Like all politicians, he made moral compromises and had moments of great leadership. He helped end the Cold War to cover up the Iran-Contra scandal. He appointed Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. He was a Republican, took the environment seriously. He was obviously the Willie Horton candidate, and he was the man who signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. So what does George H.W. Bush's presidency mean to you? 877-301-8970. You know, I always assume whenever we mention Willie Horton as if it is a, you know, everybody knows what it was. Horton was a guy who was serving a life sentence for murder, I think without the possibility of parole, if I'm right. I'm pretty sure. And he was the beneficiary of this weekend furlough program, and I think people know the rest of the story. He ultimately was convicted of armed robbery and rape, and now I think he's in Maryland. I think he's in Maryland where he's serving his sentence. And the interesting thing about this, which I've mentioned in the past, first person to mention Horton in the program was not George W. Bush. It was H.W. Bush. It was actually Al Gore's campaign, but not with the racist imagery and all that sort of stuff. That was a Lee Atwater creation for a PAC or some such thing. It was
Roger
supporting
Ailes worked
George
for him too,
H.W. H.W. Bush. It was horrible. But there are a ton of incredibly important and wonderful things. The Clean Air Act, it was Clean Air. Americans with Disabilities Act, as we talked about before. He had the courage, as Shannon O'Brien said before, which it's hard to find a Democrat or a Republican who's willing to say my campaign pledge was X, read my lips, no new taxes. But what America needs is for me to do a 180, even though it's going to cause me some harm, enough harm that he was at 91% approval after the Gulf War, and he lost in part because of the economy and part because of violating that pledge. You don't see that in very many politicians of either party. So he's a mixed bag, like everybody. But the last thing I'll say, let me say one more thing, is I think the point that Shannon made at 11:06 is the most important point that's going to be made. The prism through which we see George H.W. Yeah. Bush, at least now, immediately after his death Friday, is through the presidency of Donald Trump, who is, I think it's fair to say, H.W. Bush is all things that Donald Trump is not. So we want your thoughts. 877-301-8970. Through what prism do you see the late President Bush?
And one of the most disgraceful things he did was he was on the wrong side of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, he was running for Congress. Yeah.
Discrimination in schools and housing and employment. But, you know, it was interesting. He left Connecticut and Maine and the East Coast and all that, and Yale, where he went to school, to drive down to Texas to make his fortune there. It was very funny, the thing that I did not know, that apparently they first, George H.W., little George and Barbara, lived in a duplex and shared a bathroom with mother-daughter hooker team.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that they lived in a very modest place when they first got there, and he wanted to set out and make his own fortune. But that's where he began his political life, was in Texas, and that was a problem for him because he had that kind of Yankee noblesse oblige social liberalism in Massachusetts, but he couldn't win that way in Texas. So he was moving further and further to the right. And remember, he ran against Lloyd Benson and lost when he ran for Senate, I believe it was.
Lloyd Benson, who ended up being the vice presidential nominee for Mike Dukakis in 1988.
And he was trying, his thought was he was going to run against a more liberal Democrat, but he ended up running against a more conservative Democrat, Lloyd Benson, and he lost. So I think that was part of the problem for Bush. Doesn't certainly excuse it, but he was certainly on the wrong side of those things. And he gave Dukakis a tough time about the Pledge of Allegiance in Massachusetts, which, again, you know, was he wanted to be like the big, much more red meat Republican guy when he was running for office in Texas, and again when he was running for president. The only thing
worked, by the way.
It did work. It did work.
And Michael Dukakis, to this day, who is as self-aware as they come, says that big mistake, that he ran not a good campaign, and that his greatest failure was Michael Dukakis, was failure to fight back on things like this Willie Horton thing.
But you know what was an incredible thing? I remember when this happened, too. They had a Newsweek cover, and when Bush was talked about in terms of the wimp factor. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how the hell do you call somebody a wimp who fought, was the youngest.
Wasn't he underage
pilot.
Or the youngest? Yeah.
Well, I thought he was underage, but I may have been mistaken because I was reading this weekend that he signed up at 18.
The moment
he became 18 and was one of the youngest, if not the youngest fighter pilot at the time. I think he flew over 50 missions. And of course, as people know, his plane was hit by the Japanese and he parachuted out. He survived and the other crewman did not survive. And he always felt guilty about that. But how can you call that guy a wimp? I found that absolutely incredible. But that was something that stuck to him. And you almost wonder whether he had to ride around these cigarette boats and jump out of airplanes to like kind of combat that ridiculous notion that a guy that had that kind of courage and bravery at such a young age could be a wimp. But there was this great thing, and I'll shut up in a second. There was a great picture of him taking George W. Did you see 60 Minutes last night?
No.
It was great.
They had Obama and Clinton.
Obama and Clinton and W., his son, mm-hmm. talking about H.W. Bush. And one of the things George W. Bush talked about was how when Putin came to visit up in Kennebunkport, they had a great picture. It's worth looking up online of Putin between the two Bushes, the elder and then the younger, up in Kennebunkport. And then, of course, the elder Bush takes him out in a cigarette boat. He was famous for having that cigarette boat up in Maine. And those things go really, really fast. And W. talked about how the Russian interpreter was like petrified, white-knuckled, as George Sr. goes spinning off into the ocean in the cigarette boat. But, of course, Putin, being Mr. Macho, seemed to love all the wave crashing they were doing up there. So, anyway, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Where are you on Bush the Elder, your memories, what you think of him? And Dan Quayle and Clarence Thomas, we should also mention.
Well, Clarence,
too.
I don't think Dan Quayle's an embarrassment. He's an embarrassment a la Sarah Palin,
Clarence
I would
Thomas
argue. Except, whereas Clarence Thomas
has
had an impact
too
on our lives. I'm not sure there was any impact of Dan Quayle. There's a huge impact
especially
of Clarence Thomas. And by the way, there were a lot of conservative African-American candidates who would have been wonderful
Supreme
candidates.
Court justices, and that was another one of his failures of going to please that increasingly right-wing, I would say intolerant side of the Republican Party. Anyway, let's
John
go
in
to
Somerville.
John in Somerville.
Hi. That didn't go well. Is it something I said, John, or was it not? John, call back if you well, it's too late. The lines are full, but call back in a minute if you'd like.
Hi, Jamal in Roxbury. Hi.
Hey, Jamal, what's up?
Hi, this is Jamal in Roxbury.
Oh, Jamal, how are you?
Hi.
We know Jamal.
Very well. Happy holidays.
Good
to
talk
too.
To you.
Yes. So, George Bush, let's not forget that he was the head of the CIA and had a hand in, you know, importing tons of cocaine into America, and which ushered in, you know, crack cocaine in the urban communities. You know, that's number one.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Too, yeah, that's a big part of the scandal there. And then also, too, let's not forget, this is still the guy that gave us Jeb and George Jr.
Well, I don't think we can accuse him for fatherhood, can we, Jamal? I mean,
I think so.
You can. You do.
He failed in some way, and it has shown out in their adulthood.
Hey, Jamal, before you go away, do you want to publicize your publication for those that don't know about it?
Blackstonian.com. Thank you for the opportunity.
Jamal, it's good to talk to you.
Hold on one second,
sorry.
Jamal. I mean, and also, obviously, as I just said, he was pretty lousy on civil rights. And he opposed, coming from Texas, he took up the right wing on the Civil Rights Act of 64, too.
And his Laura Bush with the textbooks in Texas. I mean, the whole Bush family has been no friend.
What about
to
the textbooks?
African-American people.
In Texas.
Laura Bush controls the majority of the textbooks or works or, you know, owns the company or whatever that controls the majority of textbooks that are in public schools throughout the country. And they were the ones that wanted to push back a lot of the Black history stuff, reframing Martin Luther King, removing Malcolm X. There's a lot of big controversies with the textbooks as it relates to Black history and stuff. And Laura Bush was at the center of that. Let's not forget the grandfather, Prescott Bush. I mean, the Bush is a very conflicted family and has not been a friend to
Jamal, did you ever read the Kitty Kelly book on Bush that you know, one of her sort of gossipy great little bios? Because you'll appreciate, do you know what Laura's nickname, according to Kitty Kelly, was?
Nickelbag Laura or something?
Nickelbag Laura.
Supposedly
Jamal,
she was
good to talk to you.
Selling weed back in the day. We don't know if that's true.
By the way, Tori, our coworker, just posted for us from the 1996 New York Times. Government agents lured a drug, this is the New York Times, lured a drug dealer to the park in front of the White House to buy crack for a prop in President Bush's televised speech on drugs, a move the president testily defended today. And later, they later imprisoned a 19-year-old black dealer for years for selling out the outside the White House as part of this political stunt. That's the New York Times archives.
Boy, thank you for that, Tori, because I had forgotten his role in a crime. And that was another big issue, of course, that you would get a much tougher sentence if you were if you were smoking crack cocaine than if you were snorting powder cocaine. And the allegation was, and I think with a lot of truth behind
racial
it,
differential.
Yeah, that white people were snorting and black people were smoking.
Will and Spencer, you're next. We're talking about the legacy of H.W. Bush. Hello there, Will.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. First time caller.
Whoa.
I've been listening for years.
Thank you for all that. We appreciate it.
Well, let me start by saying this. I have virtually no memory of George Bush as president because I was born in 1991.
Okay.
I'm a history teacher now, and I got to say, from a historical perspective, by far the most interesting thing to me about George Bush's presidency was that he managed to get the entire world onto the same side of one issue when it came to the Gulf War. And that's something I don't think any American president nowadays could do, certainly not the one we're stuck with.
Well, but including, as a history teacher, you know better than I, another president who wasn't able to do it in that part of the world was his son.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, that's a pretty good point. I do have a lot of memories of that, Bush. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, Will, call us again soon, will you? Thanks for your first call, and we're glad you're a history teacher. That's a great life to choose. Thank you.
One of the things Obama said last night, I thought this was a great metaphor. He said that H.W. had to, quote, land the plane
that was a great
when the
line.
Berlin Wall came down.
Is that from 60 Minutes?
That was from 60 Minutes. And Obama talked about his great restraint and his caution. And it was Obama that used the line, lack of spiking the football. And there was great footage of, near riots when the wall was coming down in Berlin. And that Bush wasn't thumping his chest over it was a very good thing.
The term of the peace. Term that I'm sure everybody's heard, even if like Will, who's now teaching but wasn't born in 91, the Coalition of the Willing is the term that was crafted by the Bush administration to describe, as Will correctly described, a wide coalition, an international coalition of people who decided to get Iraq out of Kuwait. 877-301-8897.
And, we just talked about this with Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project. You know, who was right? Was Senior right to say, get him out of Kuwait, but don't topple the regime? Or was
Charlie thinks he was.
Bush Jr. right to say, we're going to get rid of Saddam? And look what's happened since we've gotten rid of Saddam. I mean, it's been nonstop warfare over there.
Sarah in Hyannis, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hi.
I just really find George H.W. Bush's post-presidency to be so unique. Granted, that's nothing against what Jimmy Carter's been doing with Habitat for all these years and everything else that Clinton and the founder, but I just think, like, anyone who's parachuting.
At 90.
I mean,
yeah.
Right. I mean, I just think he had this whole other life, as the CIA, everything leading up to the vice presidency and then the presidency. I think that when people are calling him the best one term president ever, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's what we need is more one term presidents. Maybe.
When you talk about his post presidential life, you mean the work with Bill Clinton and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and just I just think that he seemed to just have, like, peace about being a one-term president. You know what I mean? He wasn't, like, constantly trying to get back in the game. He wasn't doing all these paid political speech circuit. He was just like a normal person.
Well, by the way, his son, and I think there's much more to criticize in him, his son, the president, not his other ones. His son, the president, sort of stayed out of it when Barack Obama was president as well. So it sort of runs in the family. And Barack Obama did it for the most part until quite recently. I have to say, I know this is overdone, but it amplifies your point. Everybody's read it 1,000 times this weekend. Is that letter he left for Bill Clinton?
Oh, it was great.
It's just beautiful. This is the guy who beat him. He beat him. I mean, and can you imagine in this era? It was just, he did read it on 60 Minutes.
He kept the letter and he read the letter, and it was
in his Washington Post piece. He yes. Clinton wrote too. It's just
very gracious,
beautiful. And by the way, when you say that, it doesn't undo any of the things that are unpleasant in his history. It's just a moment that deserves praise. And by the way, I'd say there'd be praise for that even if Donald Trump was not a different kind of character in 2018. That's the kind of thing you want to see in a democracy. Sarah, thanks for the call.
Well, you know, remember what happened to George Bush, too. It wasn't just that Ross Perot, I think,
the elder?
Won 19% of the vote, and he only got, I think it was 38% of the vote. It was a three-way race back then. And
Clinton did not win a majority. I mean, yeah, I
right.
assume
remember Ross Perot, let's look under the hood. Look under the hood. And anyway, in one of the classic bad moments in the debates for George Bush, remember there was a recession then, and someone asked him about if he had any personal pain himself in the recession. Mm-hmm. And of course he didn't, because he was a wealthy guy. He'd been an oil man down in Texas, and he had difficulty answering the question. And of course Bill Clinton, the consummate politician, said something like, well, you know, when somebody down in Arkansas, down in Hope, Arkansas, if they can't pay their mortgage, I know that person. And I understand mm-hmm. where they're coming from. And if their house is being foreclosed on, and if their business is going down. I mean, he just laid it on the I feel your pain thing so thick. And George Bush seeming to be cold-hearted about it, looking at his watch.
So that's it. For those who have not seen that image, by the way, that was a problem. Is that in the middle of a presidential debate, H.W.
And
Bush,
then he
President
gets criticized
Bush
for not having knowing how much milk costs. But frankly, I never knew how much milk costs the entire time I was buying milk, because I think a lot of people just stick their debit card.
Well, they're also out of the world. I mean, how about, did you see the when what's the name of the great Seinfeld thing, comedians in
having
car
coffee
with coffee,
car,
whatever it is,
coffee
when Obama is
something.
Driving and Obama is so excited, it's the end of his presidency, because I think he said he hadn't driven in 7.5 years because he's not allowed to. So I agree with you. I think that was overplayed. Patricia, you're in Norwood. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
What I remember about the Bush presidency, the Bush one, was a tsunami of cocaine coming through Massachusetts. I was working as a nurse,
mm-hmm.
and thousands of people died. And I remember that Ollie North fell on his sword. And so over the years that I've been watching this family, I just feel like the more they ascended in politics, the more civil rights we lost.
Well, that's in part what Jamal was saying a few minutes ago. Patricia, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Brenier, you're in Hyde Park. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Brenier.
Hi. Good afternoon, guys.
And to you.
Hi.
It's been a while. Well, I have to sort of split my mind in two. I'm a Haitian American, so I'll tell you my American side of what I think of George Bush and the Haitian side what I think of George Bush. How's that? The American side, I think he was a decent person as a human being. As a strategist, I think politically he did well with foreign policy, especially the management of post-Soviet Union, getting the so-called New World Order, or sort of the Old World Order, sort of getting it so things did not disintegrate. I think that was very important. And one case in point was the fact that he didn't go all the way into Baghdad, because
yeah.
we can see the wisdom of that right now. The fact that Saddam Hussein, as bad as he was, those dictators, they know how to deal with their own people. I think it was a mistake for his son to remove Saddam Hussein, to tell you the truth. You know, not every place is going to be a democracy. Why don't we remove the Saudi prince or the king? You know,
well, that's a very good point.
Well, as we said earlier, a lot of people think, I amongst them, that the reason that George the son did what he did was to, quote, complete the job that the father had started, and in the minds of
no, the father didn't want to do that anyway. So that was
I agree with that.
He wanted to have, yeah. Okay, let me talk about my Haitian self.
Sure.
Haitian-wise, I cannot stand the guy because, first of all, after the overthrow of Duvalier, we had a democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and George W. Bush, having been the director of the CIA over the years, has his hands implicated in a lot of things, especially in terms of the Iran-Contra affair and with Nicaragua. All the caravan issues that we're having right now, these things started with the Reagan administration and Judge W. Bush destroying democratic infrastructure in Latin America because of their staunch anti-communist views. Mm-hmm. So in Haiti itself, since Aristide was a liberation theologian, Judge H.W. Bush pushed for him to be overthrown. And you see what's happening with Haiti.
So, Bernier, as always, thank you for your contribution to the show. You know, a bunch of people, particularly younger listeners, didn't live through the Willie Horton experience in 1988. And while I have to say it's almost impossible to air this without the visual, because the visual was a huge part. The mugshot of Willie Horton was a huge part of this ad. Here is the ad for, you can Google it too to see the image, but here is the ad in support of the Bush campaign attacking Michael Dukakis over the Willie Horton furlough in 1988. Here it is.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
You know, I'm not a political historian. I actually went to a great memorial yesterday for the great and talented John Martilla, where Vice President Biden spoke, Senators Markey and Senator Curry and Secretary of State Curry spoke, and his children. It was really, it was a huge crowd. Governor Dukakis was there, Barney Frank. Huge and beautiful event. I'm sure many people there could answer this better than I. It was this ad that helped change American politics, was it not? I mean, this was attack adism at its worst, elevated to an art form, and obviously very successful. Is that not true?
Well, yeah, it was successful, I guess. I mean, I remember during the Deval Patrick Kelly Healy race, there was another kind of
about Benjamin Laguerre
attack ad about the guy in the parking lot.
Laguerre. Wasn't it about Laguerre?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I thought it was.
It was about a guy following a woman through a parking lot.
I remember that ad.
Yeah, and I think that backfired in Massachusetts, but the Willie Horton ad obviously did not backfire. I have an email from Teddy saying that we were wrong about Laura Bush and the textbooks in Texas.
What? Well,
that she was involved in purchasing textbooks. He says that there's a he used to work there. There's a company responsible for the purchase of the textbooks and a state committee of text and school administrators that approved the books to be purchased. So I don't know enough about that. We'll have to try to get to the bottom.
Yeah, if you guys could take a look at that, that'd be great. Thanks.
John in Somerville, thank you for calling, John.
Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Hey, read my lips. No more taxes.
Yeah.
Hey, no, we tried.
Well, what do you hold?
He's a politician. What can you say?
Did you bring that up because you hold it against him that he violated his pledge?
No, not really. He's a politician, so you expect them to violate their pledge.
Well, I happen to say I look at that a little bit differently. Not that I expect him to violate his pledge, but he decided that even though there'd be a personal cost, it was good and important for America. And I would love to see more pledges violated by current politicians if the violation of the pledge actually helped average people. So, again, I respect your opinion, but I think we have a different view of what his 180 on that.
He fell on his sword.
Oh, I should say he did.
I think he knew he was going to pay a big price, but there was a terrible deficit post-Reagan, and I think he thought, and there was a recession, and I think he thought that was a good thing for the country. And that's one of the areas, I think, where you can really respect the guy, that he took a massive political hit and maybe lost his reelection because he thought he was doing something as unpopular as it was, as raising taxes is, that the country needed because of the massive tax cut that Ronald Reagan had pushed through. And, you know, it would be very interesting to see what happens if a Democrat wins in 2020, because the deficit we're facing now and the massive tax cuts that the Republicans just gave to not just the corporations, and they didn't have to go quite that low, and individuals who are millionaires and billionaires, is crushing in terms of the deficit. So it would be interesting to see what happens with that with a Democrat in the White House.
We're going to talk about some aspects of President Bush's history with the Revs as well, and whatever that is, 30 minutes or something like that. So please stick around.
But coming up, we're going to talk with Susan Orlean.
I'm really excited about this.
She writes about the biggest book burning in Los Angeles history. The fire at the L.A. Central Library is the subject of her fascinating new book. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Ginn. In her latest book, Susan Orlean writes about the 1986 fire that devastated the Central Library in downtown L.A. Out of the ashes rises a book that is also about how not only the Central Library has endured, but how the library as an institution remains a hub of civic activity, one that cannot be undone by the likes of Amazon or the Internet or maybe even Donald Trump. It's called The Library Book. And catch Susan tonight at 6:30 at the Cambridge Public Library at an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. Susan, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, before we get any further, Susan, I think Jim should tell you about how his role in the library that you're going to be speaking at tonight, when he was a Cambridge City Councilor for one illustrious term. Why don't you tell her about what you did?
Why
the
don't
library?
I not tell her?
What, go ahead.
I was on the Cambridge City Council, and by the way, the library. Have you seen the library yet?
Yeah.
It is gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, it's really inside and outside.
No, thanks to you.
Thank you very much. I voted for a different location. I voted for more centrally located, and
tinier,
I lost. So end of discussion.
Less beautiful.
But thank you for bringing that up, by the way. I really appreciate
this
it.
We've all had mistakes in our life, so you are forgiven.
I'm not saying mine was, but thank you for your support. In any case,
so Susan Orlean, tell people how you came to write about a library and a library fire.
I had been, at one point when I was in a library, really thinking about how fascinating these places are. I'm really attracted to stories about things that we think we know and we've never actually stopped and looked closely. So it was sort of bubbling around in my mind. When I began taking my son to the library, it was a chance to revisit all these memories of going to the library with my mother.
Which was so beautiful.
And it was
tell people
so,
about that, too.
Well, I grew up going to the library with my mom a couple of times a week. It was a very sort of sacred ritual of ours. The library became this place that I found just magical. And those trips in particular felt really enchanted to me. When I began taking my son, the reconnection with those memories was so intense. And I began thinking, why are libraries so evocative? I mean, my mom took me to a lot of places. It's not as if the only place she took me was the library. But my memory and my association with it was so powerful. And then I heard about the fire, which was the largest library fire in American history. And it was so overwhelming. It was in itself a fascinating story. But it continued reminding me of this ineffable quality about libraries that makes them so special. And when you hear about a library burning, your heart just drops. There is something particular about libraries that makes us feel that connected to them, that the idea of 400,000 books burning and 700,000 more being damaged, it's just sickening. So I was fascinated by the story coming from quite a few different angles,
you know,
really.
Before I read your book, I read somewhere that this is obviously a nonfiction thing. And then I start reading about it and I say it can't be nonfiction because I never heard of it if it's the largest library fire. But there's a reason that most of us never heard about it,
well,
correct?
Which in itself was fascinating because I thought, how did I never hear about this? Mm. And it just seemed baffling to me that I wouldn't have heard of it. I went to look at the New York Times the day of the fire, and the reason I looked at the New York Times was that the fire, which was in 1986, occurred when I was living in New York. So I thought, all right, what was I reading that day? I pull up the newspaper out of the archives, and there's a banner headline saying something to the effect of Soviets deny meltdown at Chernobyl nuclear plant. So the fire occurred the same day as the Chernobyl meltdown, and that's why it was lost to history a little bit.
You know, when you beautifully mentioned your connection to the library with your kid and your mother and that sort of thing, when I first heard about this book, I said, there is no way that this can be that interesting. And it's not because you are not wildly skillful, as we all, but it's a library. And
right.
We
both, no, but, I get
and, you know,
it.
And it's so funny. And then I read the review that Michael Lewis wrote, who I interviewed a few weeks ago, about another topic that I couldn't believe could ever be interesting, the infrastructure of departments of the federal government under Donald Trump. So did you have any self-doubt in the?
Oh, yes, absolutely. On one hand, I was completely compelled to tell the story and thought it was deeply interesting and emotional and suspenseful. And I thought, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then there would be other moments where I'd think, it's about a library.
Exactly.
I mean, what could make people more fearful of a book being boring than if you say, well, it's a book about a library? And you almost feel like you can see a meter go off in their mind, like, I'm giving you 1 second to talk about this and then I'm done. But I also have a contrarian streak that makes me love writing about subjects that people initially think are either too obscure to matter or uninteresting, because the fact is they are fascinating. They are. I mean, put aside whether I did a good job or not, it's a really interesting story.
Well, you also introduced us to the great Harry Peake, who is, talk about fictional and nonfictional,
yeah,
is almost like in a movie to begin with. You want to tell us a little bit about Harry Peake?
Yeah, the fire was determined very early on to be arson. And shortly after the decision was made by looking at the site that it was arson, a young man was arrested who, partly because he was telling everybody he had started the fire. He grew up outside of L.A., a good-looking, charming young guy who dreamed of being famous, of being a movie star. Not necessarily an actor, but a movie star. He was beloved by his friends, who also said the one thing about Harry is he was a compulsive liar. You couldn't believe a word he said. He ended up having 7 different alibis, which I don't know a lot about crime, but my guess is if you're going to have an alibi, it's good to have one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was in many ways a very sympathetic character because he meant no one any harm, but he just couldn't. He just was somebody who blundered through life in many ways. And the saga of the prosecution was fascinating.
And he was never convicted of anything.
He was arrested, but not convicted.
Yep.
And it turned into a kind of crazy story of him suing the city and the city suing him, ultimately coming to an unresolved sort of conclusion.
Well, tell us about the day of the fire. It started in the fiction department, is that? Which I thought was kind of interesting if you're a sleuth.
Yeah, well, and sleuth. I wanted to know which book it started in.
Exactly.
Which is the most flammable book in the library. The library in 1986 was not in good repair. They had fire alarms go off all the time because the fire alarm system wasn't good and they had bad wiring. And the place had been, for 20 years, debated over whether to tear it down and build a new building, which you would certainly understand. And they had finally decided, no, we're going to renovate this building. It's nevertheless, fire alarms went off all the time for false alarms. So on the morning of April 29th, an alarm went off and everybody evacuated very grudgingly because the feeling was, oh, God, another false alarm. The fire department arrived, looked around the building, said, yep, another false alarm. We'll just go reset the alarm. But it wouldn't reset. So they decided to take another look around. at that point, they saw a little bit of smoke in the fiction department. And while they were radioing to people outside to say, hey, we found some smoke, it exploded into a raging fire. And it burned for 7.5 hours. It reached temperatures over 2,000 degrees. Part of the reason is that it went off in the stacks, which are almost like chimneys. They're small, concrete built, almost like a column built in the building, lined with books. So if a fire gets started, it's the perfect place to burn.
And it was closed for 7 years?
7 years.
Talk a little bit about what that did to the people who worked at the library.
It was devastating. They, a lot of the librarians had what would now be diagnosed as PTSD, and the city brought in a psychologist to meet with them and try to help them. They had built their collections, which people don't realize that librarians don't simply buy every book that's out there. They deliberately choose what they feel are the books the public needs and wants. So this is a lifetime of work that literally went up in smoke. Many of them were really traumatized by the idea that the library wouldn't be available for people to use, and they were right. It was closed for 7 years. Nobody knew if the building would ever reopen. There were a number of marriages that fell apart. You know, a lot of the librarians just were grieving, and the trauma of it was really extreme.
We're talking to Susan Orlean, by the way. Her latest is the library book.
Tell us about some of these characters that you profiled. There was Wyman Jones and this Mary Jones, too, one of the few women librarians that had a chance to get a big job and then didn't. Tell us about a couple of those people.
Well, so the people who have run the library in L.A. are, I think, I would say all libraries attract very individual people, to put it just very generally. They attract a lot of eccentric, interesting, dramatic sorts. California may attract a slightly higher percentage of unusual, eccentric people. So the LA Library has been run since the turn of the century, when it was founded, by a series of dramatic characters. My favorite one, actually, was a man named Charles Lummis, who had been a newspaper man in Ohio, was hired by the LA Times, packed up his belongings, and this is in like 1898, and rather than taking the train to California, he walked and kept a journal that was published of his walk across the country. When he took over the library, he was a passionate reader and passionate about people bettering themselves at the library. He believed it really was a tool for self-improvement. It drove him crazy when people read books that he thought were stupid. So rather than removing those books from the collection, which would have been a sort of censorship, he had a cattle brand made with a skull and crossbones. And he would take the books that he felt were particularly egregious and brand them and put a slip of paper in saying, this is the worst possible book on this subject, and for better books, perhaps you should read, and then list books that he thought were better. And he was a very, very significant character. I mean, he wasn't just a nut. He was a brilliant guy who brought a lot of innovation and a sort of modern attitude to the library in 1905. But he was a very, very quirky and dramatic guy.
We're talking to Susan Orlean. The book is The Library Book. You know, the coincidence in time is unbelievable. You don't know this, but twice a week we broadcast our show from the central branch of the Boston Public Library, actually.
And no, it's too bad you're not there.
Tuesdays and
Fridays.
We have a huge
space with all renovated section of the library.
We share with a cafe. It's really beautiful.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And where do we go on Friday?
Well, that's it. The reason I thought of this is because Marjorie and I were taken on our second
tour of the bowels of the library by David Leonard, who runs as the head of the library, and two of his wonderful staff people. And the reason that so we were in the stacks, by the way, when you mentioned it, was really, it resonated. But the thing that, if you didn't hear the introduction of Susan a few minutes ago, while the book is about, obviously, the fire, the greatest fire, library fire of them all, but it's also about the library as an institution. One of the things, you turned, I don't even know if you remember, you turned to David Leonard during our hour-long tour on Friday and said, you know, what's the future of libraries in the era, which you address powerfully. And so David answered the question quite well. What's your answer, Susan Orlean?
Well, I think it's a very legitimate question because we're seeing a move away, to some degree, a move away from printed books. Although I will say that move away is not as rapid as it had been.
And it's not the same.
It's leveling off.
Including amongst young people, we were told by the librarians on Friday, by the
way,
the assumption was people of our generation are the ones that want hard copies. And in fact, it's exactly what they said, they're returning to hard copies.
Yeah, children read hard copies.
Yeah. I the way that I've sort of explained it to people who are wondering about what's the future of libraries is to say libraries are like public parks for the mind. They are hubs of information and storytelling and knowledge, whatever media that comes in. And in the past, that was overwhelmingly books. In the present, it's books, it's music, it's computers, it's event programming, it's people sharing stories with each other, it's literacy, it's everything that we do to share this nature of knowledge and information.
Well, it's also human contact, as you make out with that Ask a Librarian or whatever the hell that's called. You know, why do you not just Google it? Because in part you want human contact,
and
right?
And similarly, the way you might go to a park for a picnic, even though you have a backyard, there's a value that I think is becoming more recognized all the time of gathering as a community. And we don't have that many places that we gather as a community that where there isn't a commercial aspect of it. We're also, and we've entered the world of people not having offices to go to for that kind of community.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are there at their workspace.
Yeah,
I've noticed.
It's a co-working space. Yeah. It's the original co-working space. Every now and again, I point out to people that we've seen the explosion of Starbucks and coffee shops in the last, 20 years. You could make a cup of coffee at home. But for the privilege of paying $7 for a cup of coffee, there's a really satisfying quality of being around other people. So libraries offer that, as well as being the center of how we share stories and knowledge. And I don't see a grim future at all. I think as long as we exist as a creatures who share knowledge and need and want to hear each other's stories and information, libraries will thrive.
Well, you know what else, and you see this at the Boston Public Library, and you mentioned the when the library opened in L.A. at 10 o'clock in the morning, the homeless people racing in to use the bathrooms. I mean,
you know, they've added a separate staff line at the Boston Public Library about 6 months ago, specifically to deal with homeless people. They serve homeless people.
Well, pretty great. Because it's, again, one of the few places where you see, we were so isolated in where we live, you know, wealthy people live in one part of town, not so wealthy people live in another part of town, etc. I mean, you come to the library. I've never been to the Los Angeles Library, but certainly the Boston Library. We come in the morning before it opens, and there are people who are sleeping outside it or sitting outside it on the bench all day long in the summertime. So it's that, too. It's that.
Oh, absolutely.
They can certainly come in, and they can sit at the cafe, and they can go use the restrooms, or they can go get a book, or they, you know, and you don't see
it,
that.
Right. I mean, it is one of the few places that we see ourselves for what our community really is. And it's everybody together. And the issue, I mean, the libraries have been heroic in their response to dealing with homeless people. That's not originally their mission. And yet they've been really pretty extraordinary in saying, you know what, it turned into our mission, and now we're going to do what we can with our resources.
We're talking to Susan Orlean. The book is The Library Book. We only have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and I want to be a groupie for a couple of minutes here.
Well, before you're a groupie, can you just briefly tell us what the experience of burning a book was like for you? I mean, talk about book, and also in the same thing, whether you see the Trumpian goal of eliminating certain knowledge from the world to be sort of a variation on a theme.
Well, it certainly, when I began writing this book, it was in a different era. I started this book 6 years mm-hmm. ago, and the idea of the possibility of knowledge being taken out of our hands was not as acute as it feels right now. It was interesting to burn a book because logically I thought, well, this shouldn't be that big of a deal. I can get another one. It's not like a Shakespeare folio. It was, and yet it was so, it's so taboo. There is something so deeply ingrained in us that makes us look at books and libraries as having a kind of human quality.
So what did it feel like to you?
Well, I explained it to somebody the other day by saying it was a little like bungee jumping without the fun part of it. I mean, I was so anxious and resistant and kind of squeamish, and then it happened so fast. And in a way, it was very upsetting because the book was gone in a flash, literally, and there was nothing left. So symbolically, it felt very ominous to think that a book with the voice of a writer and ideas and information could just be made to disappear.
It was Fahrenheit 451.
Well, that's appropriate one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, Susan Orlean, people probably know, but just in case they don't, your book, The Orchid Thief, was turned into the movie adaptation. So Meryl Streep played you. Nicolas Cage was the star.
Cooper won an Academy Award, a local guy.
Yeah, I spent some time on the set, which was really fun and a little surreal, as you can imagine. But it was... it's a great movie.
It is a great
not
movie.
A verbatim adaptation of my book.
No.
By any means, but I think it's in many ways a deeper, more interesting kind of look at the themes of the book than and at the time that the book was optioned, I remember for real saying to my husband, there is no way they can make this into a movie. They're going to have to change it up. They're going to make the crime more like someone will die, there will be a love story.
And, oh, yes, and there was.
and I was right, not that I'm a genius, but the fact is, and because the book grapples with this whole idea of what Hollywood needs for a movie versus what a piece of art needs, which really was what the movie was all about.
So did you say the same thing to your husband about this one?
Yeah, because this is going to be a movie too, I suspect.
Well, this will be, it's being adapted for television.
Oh, it is?
Yeah,
oh, great.
Which is exciting. And similarly said to my husband, I just don't quite understand how they would adapt this, except I'm going to actually work on writing the pilot.
Oh, fabulous.
So we only have about 25 seconds left, but you wrote a great piece about Tonya Harding back at the time there was in the Olympics and she was in competition with Nancy Kerrigan. You went to her hometown very briefly. Do you think she got a bad rap?
I think people didn't understand who she was. Yeah. And did she do something wrong? Yes, absolutely. I think there's no question. But I think that it was just a story about class that was so misperceived from every angle that it fascinated me. And it continues to fascinate us.
Yeah, it was a good movie. I love the movie.
Susan, it's great to meet you.
Susan Orlean's latest book is
Thanks
a library
so
book.
Much.
You can catch it tonight, 6:30 at the Cambridge Public Library in an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. Thank you very much, Susan Orlean. Enjoyed it. Up next, we're all revved up with Irene Munroe and Emmett Price. This is Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African-American Heritage Trail, visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett's professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene and Emmett, great to see you.
Thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here. And listen, happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. You're not Jewish, actually, but...
Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, similarly, I had that problem my first semester at Wellesley, because if you come from New York, you're used to your Jewish holidays, and it didn't matter.
That's a very good
And yeah. so, That's yeah, great. It didn't matter whether you were Jewish or not. You just look for the day off.
That's right. That's right.
It's not quite how I'd put it, but thank you. Nice to see you.
So I read this, and I immediately thought of Emmett and Irene, although I don't know how old this writer is. Because he talks about back when he was 9 years old. So if he's 70, then maybe it's gotten better. But basically, he talks about the fact that the black church is sexist, that women don't get to sit in the place of honor when they're going to be preaching. They don't get to preach from the pulpit. They have to go to lectern, that there was a mourner's bench for women who were pregnant to kneel in after they came back having babies out of wedlock.
Amen. I just say amen. I love this brother. And I don't even know him.
And there were... those hugs that lasted a little too long, and no one seemed to care. So, Emmett,
yes.
I'm stunned.
Don't be stunned. Don't be stunned. I mean, you know, one of the points here, and he's right, this is Lawrence Ware, if I'm not mistaken.
Looks like
right.
he's about 40. I just looked up his
yeah.
bio at
yeah.
Oklahoma
he's
State.
Young.
He looks
yeah.
like
40. Yeah, he's yeah. in his 40s.
And so I would have had the same, similar experience to him. And the challenge, though, is that that's not all black churches. And so we have to be careful in terms of how we, you know, kind of associate that within the black church, ecumenical black church across many denominations and experiences. Yes, patriarchy lives. There are a lot of misogynoirs who are present. We saw one at Aretha Franklin's funeral.
Hugging Ariana Grande.
You know, groping
Ariana
Grande. That was horrible.
That was horrible.
You know, and so that exists. And yes, as he mentions in his wonderful piece, that if there were... if the women were not present and active and phenomenal leaders in the black church would not exist.
So,
but that's also the point.
You know, I can't take it. This is Emmett ecclesiastically explaining here to defend the black church here. While I'll agree that not all this gentleman cannot speak for all black churches, those that are an exception from the rule does not negate the predominance of black male patriarchy in the church here. And what happens here with this is that what upholds it, because you'll get this argument, oh, there's so many black women in the church. Yes, we are in numbers. We outnumber them. But when you talk about church polity, church governance, that is shaped and defined and executed by black men. Also, what we cannot negate here, and this is where I feel like women are culpable, we do have black, what I call church patriarchal women, whether they're the mother of the church, head of the usher board, or whether they're the superintendent of Sunday school. You need foot soldiers to keep that kind of dominant ecclesiastical, you know, presence in the church, whether it is gendered male or female.
So Irene likes to argue with me, but she just agreed with me. I mean, she absolutely agreed with everything I just said, because the point is that at a certain time, women need to make a decision and decide whether they're going to continue to be subjugated to this heinous treatment, I'm going to call it that, or if they're going to move to other spaces. There are some phenomenal women pastors within black churches across the country who are doing extremely well. They have populations, they have flocks, they're doing great, they have privilege, they have prestige. And some of these conferences that continue to have all-male slates and all-male speakers, some of these women need to stop going to the conferences, too.
Yeah, but see, that's easier said than done. So if you live in a particular community, because we understand that the black church is really the centrality of black church in our communities, and if this has been a black church that has been in the community, and I'm talking about brick and mortar as well, not just your storefront church here, people are used to going to this particular church, and it's used to have male governance. It's not going to shift hands that easily. So while someone like myself who come up,
you know, and want to be a minister and stuff, what they do is that these then those churches that are landmarks in the community, because I certainly pastored one in the Bronx and then one in Inglewood, New Jersey. These are churches that they that are abandoned for the most part. These are dying churches. They expect you to do the Lazarus number, and we do because we try to show that we can pastor. But the point is that those churches then are dying churches. They're not thriving. It's very, very hard that the people that live in those communities expect a certain kind of way of worship. So that all I'm saying is that I agree with you in part, but it's not as easy. It's like the Catholic Church. It's not as easy as one can explain it to be in terms of what, how to move forward.
Well, at least you can be a minister in the Black Church. I don't like the Catholic Church.
Well, in some – wait, hold up now. Hold up. In some denominations. So I go to a Presbyterian church as opposed to a Black Baptist church or what I grew up as Bapticostal, because Black Presbyterian and Episcopal churches were losing Black ministers and their credentialings were much harder. So it was easier route for many folks to go into the AME as well as be Black Baptist.
So you mentioned the Catholic Church, and I want to talk about something. Have you maybe explain it to me? Here is the latest pronouncement from the Pope on homosexuality. soon-to-be-published book, he says that having gays in the clergy is, quote, something that worries me, and he remarks that some societies are considering homosexuality a, quote, fashionable lifestyle. Now, unless I'm wrong, this is the exact same Pope who said 5 years ago, if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? What happened?
Okay, see, this is why I call him a flip-flopper. This is why I say that he is a church bureaucrat. And this is another thing that is very problematic, and he's dangerous to the LGBT community, although at one point we wanted to embrace him, because what he is doing, whether he's conscious of it or not, is that he is linking pedophilia to being LGBTQ. And the truth about it is that the problem with the church is it's not as LGBT priest, because it makes the assumption that everyone is a pedophile. It's the way the church is run. And the point is this: if you didn't have those gay priests, and I'm not talking about pedophilic priests, you wouldn't have a Catholic church because of the gifts and spirit that they bring to worship.
So, my take on this is this is an old man who is totally out of touch.
Oh, he's been old
because he's too smart. Yeah. Fashionable yeah. lifestyle, yeah. all this kind. I'm not excusing this at all. I'm just trying to explain a comment that I thought was quite beautiful 5 years ago, and then a pathetic, uninformed comment.
It was like an earthquake. It was
just now. It just
well, I think, you know, in the last couple of weeks when we were talking about the Catholic Church and particularly the Pope, it's time for him to begin exit strategy number one. I mean, it's time for him to go because he's just slipping so bad away from how he came in. And it's almost a flip-flop. It's a 180. And on some very key and crucial issues. And I'm not sure. I mean, you want to say that perhaps somebody's gotten in his ear, and you know, he's just losing.
Well,
it.
No, does he not know? I mean, a huge percentage of priests are gay.
That's right. Yeah,
does he not know?
Of course he does. Of course he knows. What it is that he's trying to do damage control, scapegoating some group of a particular demographic group within his church. The issue is here. And he needs to own up to it. They don't know how to solve the church sex abuse issue, because the needed change in terms of changing, getting rid of the bishops, a kind of schooling that needs to be done, get rid of its snitch policy that needs to be done. All that needs to be done, they're not able to do it, or they refuse to do it because the church. It's a shame because it damages the potential spiritual life of the folks like even Marjorie who go to the Catholic
Church. So you're making
that
connection because all of a sudden the reason he's concerned about the fashionable lifestyle is because he blames those people in his clergy for having done that which he can't solve.
Yeah, can't solve.
Okay, and he's buying into the.
He can't solve it. That's an easy go-to. Look, listen. Society automatically thinks that if pedophilia exists, it has to do with LGBTQ or sexual orientation. It's cheap.
By the way, for whatever it's worth, a good friend of ours has reminded us regularly since the church abuse crisis exploded here, roughly a third of the survivors, victims and survivors, were young girls.
That's
right.
Young boys. That's right. And what we got to understand is that while when we really got upset about this issue is when it was raping little young boys, because for decades, little girls were being raped by the priest.
Some priests went after both boys and girls.
That's right. As well as nuns. See, that's another story that we don't talk about. Nuns that have been raped by priests.
So I felt immediately like I was what they were writing to in this Washington Post story. It said, white liberals dumb themselves down when they speak to black people. A new study contends. And they talk about this book club where if the club secretary is writing out a note to Emily versus Lakeisha, she's going to speak with use words like melancholy and euphoric with Emily and sad or happy
if
with
you're a
Lakeisha.
Liberal. If you're a conservative, you don't change. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Well, yeah, conservatives don't do that, but that's not because they're more evolved, it's because
they don't care.
They don't care.
Yeah, they don't care to. So that's their code switching.
Yeah.
That's what I call white code switching.
So how horrifying is this story?
They call it competence. They call it competence downshift. Listen, this is what I say. I'm not surprised at all. Okay, because I say two things. If you're the Mason-Dixon line does one thing. If you're below it, it's down south. If you're above it, it's up south. And how racism shows its face has a lot to do with region and generation, you know, and expression. We're not surprised.
So you're over there in Cambridge. You are surrounded with all your education and status and achievement.
Right.
Are you surrounded by people who don't talk down to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I do all the time. You know what I define liberal racism to be? I find it to be a toxic mixture of good intentions with unexamined implicit racism, because it's the whole idea that I'm going to relate to you. I'm trying to be an ally, and they think like they're talking to a child. It's very patronizing.
It's like the rescue notion that you talk about all the time in those movies that you hate, like in The Help and that sort of
stuff.
Right.
The Wind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What's your take on that?
Mississippi Burning, for that matter.
Very similar to Irene. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, and I'm not big on titles or whatnot, but you know, if I get called, you know, Emmett versus Mr. Price versus Reverend Price versus Reverend Dr. Price, you can tell who's talking to me based on what the nomenclature is and what people use. It's the same thing. So, you know, not you two.
I mean, no, we're
friends. We're friends. But the notion of, you know, if I'm dressed in my radio uniform versus my TV uniform, versus my preaching uniform, versus my, you know, kind of statesman uniform. Again, you see
the
people,
assumptions.
People make assumptions based on how you dress.
Know? I went to Boston Medical Center to see about my eye, and so the doctor comes out and a young one too, and says, "So you know, how can I help you?" And I said, "Well, I have a lot of anxiety. I don't know if I'm having a side effect, and I want you to assuage my anxiety. Is this should my eye be behaving the way it is?" He says, "Oh, that's a very, very sophisticated word for you."
No, that is not true.
Yes, it is. I wore his A out. Okay, because then wait a minute. Let me tell you how he changed. He changed his disposition. I said, you know, I come here because my spouse is a doctor here. Okay, wait a minute. And I said, she's
in management.
Wait. And I said, she's now.
Okay,
I said, she's now in management. I said, you know, but I can't wait to tell Dr. Thea how the visit went. Okay? And I said, so the point is that assumption.
How did that go, by the way?
Oh, he got it. Oh, he absolutely got it. Then come back with his tail between his leg, you know, and he's acting obsequious. And he understood that I knew that word too.
Okay, I have a confession. It's not about race. But it's about class, because I remember once in high school, I was ridiculed forever because I was at a basketball game and I said, "Look at the deficit in the score," and I was totally ridiculed by.
What the hell's that got to do with this?
Because, that's not basketball language.
Well, it's about people. So after that, I didn't talk that way, and when I go home, I start talking in the same kind of accent that my parents. Mm-hmm. So that's not racism, but it's similar, I guess.
What is it then?
It's that I don't want people to ridicule me for talking in the way I learned to talk when I left
So is it class shame? Is it class shame?
I think it's intersectional.
Oh, it definitely is. Oh, without. But see, this is what I feel, you know, because one of the things is that we like to say all white people are racist.
Yeah.
And I don't really buy into that, to that category here. I always say that we cannot be blamed for information we have been taught or have absorbed from our U.S. culture and society. But I feel that you will be held responsible for repeating misinformation after you have learned otherwise here. And so I think that's important. And I think when we define racism, I'm always talking about sort of a white collective bias and advantages, whether it's implicit or explicit, that support both legal authority and institutional control. I'm not saying that white people don't have isms, like homophobia, classism, which I think you're talking about, or regionalism. I'm just saying that racism isn't one that you have to confront.
By the way, before you continue, only because it's stuck in my head now, after you said deficit, I looked it up to be right. Remember during the campaign, when Ted Cruz, the reelected senator, referred to it as the basketball ring. My God.
But you know how politicians do this, too? They'll drop their INGs. Mm-hmm. Try and
how about Hillary Clinton in that horrible speech years ago?
Wait a minute. And she got on a black show. Do you remember that black show?
Sauce.
And she brought
hot,
she said,
oh, out of her bag. Okay. It was a radio show,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, absolutely here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that kind of stuff here of you're either appropriating culture, thinking that that's the way you should speak to us, as opposed to just speak to us as human beings. It's sort of like we tell people, don't talk baby talk to children. Just talk to them.
Or old people.
Oh, right, okay. Right, there you go. Right. Absolutely here. So, I mean, it's those sort of things that I just find. It might be code switching, but I find it insulting.
Can I tell another anecdotal horrible story? I'm sorry to keep the...
Is it about me?
I'm not going to say it is. There's a very famous chef in town that's Asian. And I bump into them at dinner, and this particular chef's parents are in town, and they speak very little English, and the spouse of this particular chef is not Asian, is a white person, and I'm introduced to the parents, and because they speak very little English, I am speaking really loudly in a public place, and the spouse says to me, you know, Jim, yelling at them probably won't get them to understand what you're trying
better.
To say.
Any better.
One of the most humiliating.
But this is what happens here. So your white friends will do this, like, so they'll go, yo, what's up, girl? And they'll say, girlfriend.
Oh, God.
And, you know, and it's like,
or,
really?
Hey, brother.
Hey, yeah, there you
hey,
go.
Hey, sister.
Yeah, and all stuff like, show me some love. Show me some love.
Oh, okay.
I felt pretty bad at the beginning of this segment. Let me tell you, right now it is real. I think they're talking about us, Mark. Good to see you both.
Oh, you know what? We are, but we code switching.
We are?
Okay.
We should continue this now. This is a great story. It's in the Washington Post. Isaac Stanley Becker wrote this thing. It is great.
Yeah,
it is. Good to see you both.
Thank you very much. The Reverend Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Emmett Price is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston Voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU's School of Theology. Up next, Jerry Springer's return to TV. Bad news for the Murphy Brown reboot and other TV news with Bob Thompson, our TV man. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Mardrigan. In his latest attack on the so-called fake news industry, specifically CNN, President Trump is taking a page right out of Russia's TV guide, state-run television. Last week he tweeted, quote, CNN is a powerful voice portraying the U.S. in an unfair and false way. Something has to be done, including the possibility of the U.S. starting our own worldwide network to show the world the way we really are, capital letters, great, but don't we have such a network already? as Marjorie said in Fox News. Joining us to talk about this and other TV developments is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, how are you guys?
Excellent, thank you.
We are very well, Bob Thompson. So is Trump's worldwide TV network plan possibly your worst?
It is. I mean, I'm not terribly worried that this is actually going to happen, but the fact that the president of the United States would come out loud, say out loud what you just quoted that he said is really spooky. Now, that isn't to say that we don't have our own state-run propaganda media already in existence. Voice of America has been around for a long time. Radio Marti that broadcasts from Florida into Cuba. I mean, this is stuff that we do, but this idea of a state-run television station, which is to compete with CNN, and he goes after CNN because they've got, of course, a big international presence. It's just yet another really spooky kind of statement that, 3 years ago we could never have believed would have been uttered by the president.
Well, don't remember, weren't they planning, had he lost the election, to start this Trump TV, weren't they? I mean, that apparently
was... Well, not only were they planning it, they actually, we talked about this, they did a little, it wasn't, they didn't have, of course, a cable network, but they did a couple of things that were incredibly amateur, that looked like something that came out of a not only a college television station, but a college television station with a really bad television department.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Bob Thompson. So that's the worst. What's the best there, Bob?
Oh, let's see. I think I'll have to give my best to the career of Steven Hillenburg, who died on Monday, but I didn't find out till after we talked. And he, of course, was a marine biologist. He did a couple of other things on television, but his magnum opus, of course, was one of the most, I think, will ultimately be one of the most iconic characters of American childhood, and that is SpongeBob SquarePants.
Well, let's play a little sound, and then I want to have you explain why you think that. Here, SpongeBob is overjoyed that his boss, Mr. Krabs, obviously, has decided to make the Krusty Krab into a 24-hour restaurant, which means he gets to spend more time with his colleague Squidward.
Isn't this great, Squidward? Just you and me together for hours and hours and hours, and then the sun will come up, and it'll be tomorrow, and we'll still be working. It'll be just like a sleepover, only we'll be sweaty and covered with grease. Are you ready to rock, Squidward?
No.
Good, because we've got customers. Squidward, I'm working in the kitchen. At night. Hey, Squidward, guess what? I'm chopping lettuce. At night. Look at me, I'm swabbing the bathroom. At night. Ow! I burned my hand! At night.
So why'd you give it such high praise there, Bob?
Well, I think this is, I mean, this started in 1999. It was spectacularly and continues to be popular. You could, at its heyday in the early part of the century, you could look at the 20 highest rated shows on cable television, and 9 to 12 of them would be episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants, many of them having run for the second, third, fourth, fifth times. The rest would be wrestling programs. But also the, you know, other children's programming aimed at preschoolers and the really young, many parents can tell you that their kids used to love shows like Barney, the Purple Dinosaur.
Sure.
But when the kids were staring at that show, the parents were listening in the other room and they wanted to jump off a bridge.
Very true.
SpongeBob SquarePants, the kids loved it, but parents would all, yeah. There was so much there that they could also appreciate. The older you got, the more you saw in that show. They did an episode called The Paper. It was like 11 minutes long. And it was about how SpongeBob could take a piece of trash, a gum wrapper, and with his creative mind, practically go to heaven with what he could do with it. It is one of the most beautiful 11 minutes of television I have ever seen in my many, many years of watching television.
Wow, that is a pretty broad statement there. So you have to clarify a little confusion for me. Murphy Brown is done, but she's not canceled. How do you reconcile those two things?
The show was given a 13-episode order, which is often how new shows get ordered. But oftentimes then, if the show is doing okay, if there's confidence in it, they will order another 7 or another 10 or whatever. Or in some cases, they'll renew it very early on. Murphy Brown's ratings were disappointing, especially compared to other reboots like The Conners and Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. And it didn't get a reorder. It still has not gotten a reorder. So by the end of December, when its 13th episode plays, another show has been scheduled in its time slot. So there's been no announcement that it's canceled, but there is also absolutely no indication that it is going to go on. I would say all our odds are the fact that this last episode in December will be, in fact, its final episode.
You know, Bob, you just mentioned Conners, the show that's going on without Roseanne. It's doing okay?
Yeah, I mean, it still hasn't been on long enough to really make any determination. And they've started going in some new directions. One of the main characters is pregnant now. But we'll have to see. Again, that show debuted with about the same ratings that the original Roseanne reboot ended with last spring. So I think its chances of continuing are better.
And what was wrong with Murphy Brown? Just bad comedy?
Did you see it, by the way?
No, I didn't.
It wasn't. I mean, particularly if you saw the first one, which I assume some viewers, it just did not have the bite and the speed and... What's-his-face was dead, too, and he was a huge part of the show. What was the name of the guy who was always working in her house? Elroy or
Elden.
Whatever that
was? Oh, yeah, yeah. Elden,
yeah, right, yeah.
He's gone, right. I think the problem with that show was that it came back and it really was true to what it had been originally in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. But you can't do shows in 2018 the way you did it before. It seems more heavy-handed. They did actually a really interesting episode this past week where one of the main characters gets beat up at a Trump rally. Mm. And that would have been, we would have been, you know, going critically crazy. We would have been genuflecting if a show with that kind of political relevance had been played back in, you know, 1992 and back when Murphy Brown was doing the Dan Quayle episodes. But today, this 90s approach to politics just, I don't think works. And there are times I wanted to love that show so much, but I rolled my eyes a lot during it.
So let's play some sound. I mean, it's very hard to do a show without playing some sound from Jerry Springer. So here he is. Here's a yeah. clip where a man reveals that he cheated. This is, I guess, every show. A man reveals he cheated on his girlfriend after she proposes to him. Please listen.
I had one nice thing with your friend, Jessica.
Oh, my God.
It was last week when you dropped me off at work, because I remember you saying she was a slut and that she would do anything with anybody.
Of course.
So she came to my work. She always gets what her dollar menu items, whatever. So I asked her if I gave her a free chalupa, if she'd go in the bathroom with me and give me a and I was just joking. And she ended up waited for me to go off work and went to the bathroom with me and did that.
What is wrong with you?
I mean, it was a free chalupa. What does he expect? Now, you know, I don't think most people realize that before Jerry Springer became the host of maybe the lowest rent television show, maybe ever, he was actually the mayor of Cincinnati. You know that. But
yeah, he was a lawyer for more than 15 years. He served, I think, like 5 terms on the Cincinnati City Council. Mm-hmm. And he eventually was elected mayor. So this guy had quite a political background. He was never, however, a judge. But that's not going to stop the new announcement that he's going to be one on TV.
So what happened? His show got canceled? Is that what happened after a quarter century or something?
Well, it went a long, long time. I mean, it didn't. I think it went until July of this year, if I'm not mistaken. So show had a really long run. And as we always say, and I don't know whether this is praise or not, but he did what he did very, very well. I mean,
I agree with that.
And then I remember those days when he used to do those little morals at the end of the story, which were actually sometimes pretty well written. That show could be
believe it or not, socially responsible after they'd done the things like we just played that that clip just
there. Chalupa quit. You know, before we leave this, this is a quiz for Marjorie because you probably know, Bob.
I don't know.
No, you may. It's relevant to Judge Jerry Springer.
Uh-huh.
Who was the highest paid talk show host on television last year, and what did she make?
I would say Judge Judy.
That is correct. And how much did she make last year?
I don't know. $5 million?
$5 trillion.
$147 million Judge
You're
Judy
kidding.
Made from her television show last year. I assume she owns it. I don't know. But 147.
Wow.
So Springer picked the proper
calling,
occupation.
But you know, we should keep that in mind. You know, we're always talking about this fancy shows and the high
exactly
literate
right.
nature of television and all of this stuff. And even at late night, all the politically relevant stuff that's going on. But we really do have to remember that if we're talking about American television, that statistic about Judge Judy that you just gave is an important one to keep in perspective what American television really is.
I guess so. I didn't know what a chalupa was. What's a chalupa, Jim?
Well, it gets you what he got. That's all
you
need to know. You
should leave the studio right now and treat yourself to one.
Okay. So what to watch, Bob Thompson?
Well, we have a second for this. AMC, for people into Christmas movies, AMC, did I read this right? 600 hours, that can't be right, of Christmas movies in the next month? Is that right?
Well, I don't know. I have to do the math. Is there 600 hours in the next
month?
I don't know.
There's 720 hours in a month.
A lot of it. And forget AMC. You should check out Lifetime and Hallmark and those kinds of places. But AMC did something interesting. Let's remember, by the way, this is AMC Breaking Bad AMC.
This is a fancy place.
And they did what I think was really interesting on December 1st, Saturday, I guess it was, where they did I think it was maybe 10 hours, 12 hours of a retrospective of the Rankin-Bass company, which went from the mid-60s to about the mid-80s. And anybody of a certain age, certainly baby boomers, would recognize in an instant the logo at the end of each of those shows. They did, of course, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which still beats its time slot, even though it's over a half a century old. They did Frosty the Snowman, which still beats its time slot, even though it's over a half a century old. But they had a whole bunch of other programs that they did that kids would have watched at that time, but that didn't quite live up to that classic status. And they played 12 hours of those on Saturday, and not a household name, but a production company that was very important to two generations of kids.
We're talking to Bob Thompson, our TV guy.
Okay, what to watch this week, Bob?
Well, I came a little late to this. I'm sorry. It debuted on November 18th on HBO, and it's already had 5 episodes of its 8. But if you get HBO, it's easy to go back and watch the old ones. And it's My Brilliant Friend.
Yeah.
Warning, though, it's in Italian.
Oh, it is?
So you have to actually watch it.
Subtitled, but in Italian.
You know, I have to say, I haven't seen any of it yet. Every single person
heard,
I've spoken to, what is so terrific about it? I mean, I know the Ferrante novels.
Well, I was
talking
to your fabulous producer, Chelsea, and she, of course, has been waiting to read the novel. I have to admit, even though it's based on a tetralogy of novels, this first series is based on the first novel, I missed it entirely. I had not heard of the novel. I had, in coming to this for the first time. But it takes place in Naples, and it's about a kind of prodigiously intelligent couple of young women. The actors that play them when they're in elementary and middle school, and then the two actors that play them when they're in high school, are absolutely brilliant. And it, like a lot of these things these days, it takes a while to get to. I would give it 3 episodes. If you don't like it after 3, then you're probably not going to like it. But
well,
I would
give
it a little bit of...
One of my best friends who grew up in Italy, you know him, Tony.
Of course.
He went on and on about how accurately they portrayed that period of time in Italy and the way it was growing up there, even though he didn't grow up in Naples. He's raving about it.
Well, you know, it's also, I find, intriguing, which I guess doesn't have much to do with it. Well, I guess it does with a television show. I hope I'm not wrong about this. No one knows who Elena Ferrante is. Is that not right? Doesn't she write under a pseudonym?
Again, I am coming late to this.
Me too.
When I was looking up Elena Ferrante, she's her identity, even by some estimates, if she's even a her, is quite mysterious. She's given interviews and all of that, but she's. She makes Salinger look transparent.
You know, we only have 30 seconds here. I don't know if you spoke positively of this before, but almost every weekend I engage in binge watching of a new show. Not a new show, a new show to me. And I usually watch thrillers and that sort of stuff. I watch a lot of hours of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel this weekend. I hope you loved it. I think it's one of the best things I've seen in a long time. Did you like it or did you not? Bud?
I have spoken positively about it before, and I will be happy to use the last 5 seconds to speak positively about it again.
Great.
Oh, good.
I'm
okay.
Glad you did.
So
it is spectacular. The cast is spectacular.
It won a bunch of awards,
it is
too.
It's really brilliant. It's brilliantly done.
It's not underappreciated. It's being lauded with praise.
Well, I'm late to the fair. Good to talk to you, Bob Thompson. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Bob Thompson.
You too. Thanks.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse.
Have you seen Mrs. Maisel?
No, but everybody's telling me it's great, so I'm going to start watching
really,
it. I'm so behind.
It is great.
I got to watch this.
What do you do if you're not watching television?
I mean, I'm watching CNN. It's ridiculous. I'm wasting my life. Up
okay,
next,
fine.
Another edition of Village Voice with poet Richard Blanco. You are listening to Boston Public Radio. 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to lead another edition of Village Voice, where we discuss poetry and how it can help us better understand our lives and times. This is Richard Blanco. Richard, of course, is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest project is the Fine Press book. It's called Boundaries, a collaboration with photographer Jacob Hessler. Richard, good to talk to you.
Good to be here again. It's
hello,
wonderful.
Hello, Richard. Thank you very much for coming in, as always. So what are we doing today?
Well, I thought we'd start doing something a little bit different and sort of highlighting one particular poet and sort of getting to know them a little more, deeply, and so reading a few of their poems and thinking about what their work looks together more than just a one-off. And today I picked Ada Limón, who is not only a fantastic poet but a fantastic person and actually one of my sort of one of my spiritual poet friends in this world.
My God.
Yeah.
How do you know her?
We met in an elevator at a conference, and it was love at first sight. And we keep on running. It's just these serendipitous moments, and her work just slays me and inspires me and makes me cry and makes me laugh, and it's amazing.
Where's she based?
She's originally from Sonoma, California, and she's been living in Louisville, Kentucky. I think it's Louisville, but Kentucky for many years. And she also is interesting because she's also has sort of came to poetry from not from the usual route. She's a magazine writer. I often see some of her articles in airplane magazines and whatnot. And so she's had another kind of life. And obviously has a lot of poems about the Kentucky Derby and about horses and whatnot that's made it into her work lately.
Richard, you know that Marjorie's favorite movie of all time. Do you know what Marjorie's favorite movie is? This is a sad commentary. Do you know what it is?
Secretariat. Yeah, I love it.
Well,
it is a good movie.
I got to send you some more of Ada's poems then.
Yeah. It's a very sappy Disney movie, but I really liked it. Richard, I know we're going to you're going to read three of her poems, but in the preparation material Chelsea got for us, it mentioned that she has a new collection, The Carrying, that is called Her Best Yet. So tell us what the poems are from so people want to go out and get the book.
I'm not familiar with that yet. She hasn't contacted me about that. I thought she'd send me a blurb, but if it's her best yet, I don't know how she can top herself. I wrote a review, a small review, an endorsement for her Bright Dead Things, which was just an amazing collection. So I'm looking forward to that. That's great news to me. I didn't know that.
Okay.
she should tell me.
She's very modest, I guess.
So what are we going to start with, Richard Blanco?
Well, this is called The Leash, and it's I picked this poem in particular because my dog passed away on Saturday.
We heard. I'm so sorry.
Oh, Richard, we saw the picture of you and the dog.
That's beautiful, actually.
We're going to put him up on the website along with Ada, and Ada has this beautiful I believe it's one of those French bulldogs. I may get it wrong. But I read this poem online, and I see her the next day at the conference with the dog. These are the kinds of serendipities that we have.
You know, speaking of, I read the poem this morning, and it is really beautiful, and we'll hear it from you in a minute. But it's sort of reversing roles. Speaking of dogs and death, there's a beautiful photograph, I don't know if you've seen it yet, of George H.W. Bush's service dog lying in front of his casket in Houston. Oh. Did you see this?
No,
it is really so incredibly powerful.
Do you mind my asking what happened to your dog?
He was sort of misdiagnosed for a few weeks, but it ended up being lymphoma. And so by the time it was diagnosed, it was a little too late. He was already 11, so he was a little old to fight back. But he did pass away at home in front of the fireplace, so it was a good going, and it was a nice send off. This poem sort of touches on that, but it's also there's so many layers, as you'll see. But it's called The Leash. After the birthing of bombs, of forks and fear, the frantic, automatic weapons unleashed, the spray of bullets into a crowd holding hands, that brute sky opening in a slate metal maw that swallows only the unsayable in each of us, what's left? Even the hidden nowhere river is poisoned orange and acidic by a coal mine. How can you not fear humanity? Want to lick the creek bottom dry to suck the deadly water up into your own lungs like venom. Reader, I want to say, don't die. Even when silvery fish after fish comes back belly up and the country plummets into a precipitating crater of hatred, isn't there still something singing? The truth is, I don't know. But sometimes, I swear I hear it, the wound closing like a rusted over garage door, and I can still move my living limbs into the world without too much pain, can still marvel at how the dog runs straight toward the pickup trucks, breaknecking down the road, because she thinks she loves them, because she's sure, without a doubt, that the loud roaring things will love her back, her soft, small self, alive with desire to share her goddamn enthusiasm, until I yank the leash back to save her because I want her to survive forever. Don't die, I say. And we decide to walk for a bit longer. Starlings high and fevered above us, winter coming to lay her cold corpse down upon this little plot of earth. Perhaps we are always hurtling our bodies toward the thing that will obliterate us, begging for love from the speeding passage of time. And so maybe, like the dog obedient at my heels, we can walk together peacefully, at least until the next truck comes.
Love the end.
So, you know, and it's this is so layered, but, you know, one of the things, you know, how, you know, we with our pets and of course the dog being sort of becomes this trope here, right? But how we want to sort of, we're always in charge of their lives, right? We're always in charge of trying to save them, and can we even save ourselves, right? And so it's amazing because she's bringing here a lot of stuff for what's going on in the country. At least I read into this, you know, the sort of mayhem we're in, and yet this quiet moment is just being with your dog, protecting what you can or feel you can, and having that quiet moment as a moment of respite and of a moment of, some sense or temporary sense of control, right?
Well, it's not just control. The leash. You know, this is the difference between poets and us. I mean, how many times we sit on the show, Marjorie, the world is so horrible, you get home, the dog with unconditional love, you know, jumps up, licks your face. I mean, well, that's how we'd say it, but not how Otto would say it, obviously.
You know that book, Everything I Ever Wanted to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten?
Yeah,
I've always thought
it
should be called Everything I Ever Wanted to Know, I Learned from My Dog. Because as you say in this poem, I mean, the dog does expect that love to come back and is so trusting and is so ready to forgive even when it's been mistreated, you know. It's dogs are such a, in many ways, depressing comparison to people, I guess.
Yeah, and just the ability of not even sensing danger and how much of the danger, I mean, you know, in the climate that we're in today, you know, of course, every day is like, I have to turn off CNN sometimes, you know, it's just too much, right? And here's this dog hurtling toward the truck who's convinced that the truck loves her.
Yeah.
You
know?
And it's such a great reminder of, like, listen, not to say that things aren't bad, but sometimes, you know, that's another thing that dogs remind us is, like, just, you know, chill.
You know? I love the way she ends it too, until the next truck comes. It's such a great ending.
Which is, of course, figuratively, because there's always a truck coming down.
Of course.
There's always some kind of truck coming down the road, right? And these days, it seems like a convoy.
That's great. That's called The Leash, again. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. What's next?
So this is called The Conditional, and I think you'll see a similar theme in all these three poems, which is how to sort of find meaning in seeming oblivion about the quiet moments of finding, you know, as I always say, the extraordinary in the seemingly ordinary. In this case, a version of that would be a kind of peacefulness in what's seemingly total chaos. So this is interesting. This is something the Academy of American Poets does, is sometimes when they post poems, they do little blurbs from the author speaking about the poem and how they wrote this. There's so much to worry about. All the time, so much worry. Here I wanted to take all the worry as far out as I could and then stamp it out under the heavy black boot of love, which alone is a poem by itself, right?
Why do they do that, by the way? I'm sort of surprised. I like it, but I'm surprised that people in the business, to use a horrible term, think that poets should explain a little.
Well, it's just sort of, I do that at readings often, you know, in live readings, just to give, it's kind of a courtesy and a nice little touch for the reader to sort of, not to tell the reader how to read it, but to give them a little bit of a door into the poem, something that they wouldn't otherwise have, though not at all completely necessary, but it's just kind of a nice touch, because in the same way you might introduce a song, you know, at a concert or something, sometimes it's just what inspired you. The poem should, of course, hold its own weight without that, but it's nice to see the underpinnings of the poem sometimes from the poets. So The Conditional. Say tomorrow doesn't come. Say the moon becomes an icy pit. Say the sweet gum tree is petrified. Say the sun's a foul black tire fire. Say the owl's eyes are pinpricks. Say the raccoon's a hot tar stain. Say the shirt's plastic ditch litter. Say the kitchen's a cow's corpse. Say we never get to see it. Bright future, stuck like a bum star. Never coming close, never dazzling. Say we never meet her, never him. Say we spend our last moments staring at each other, hands knotted together, clutching the dog, watching the sky burn. Say it doesn't matter. Say that would be enough. Say you'd still want this. Us alive, right here, feeling lucky.
Ooh.
Yeah, so there we have the dog again.
I was going to say, it's the same, right, the same thing, yeah.
And I wonder, in this poem in particular, I mean, I think I hate asking those kinds of, is it the dog or is it, but like, it could be almost read as, like, it's just her and the dog there just waiting for the this apocalyptic oblivion.
Yeah.
and that's fine because I got my dog, right? In some ways, again, surrendering control and thinking about it, but also surrendering this idea that things that life is full of tremendous tragedies and things that we can't control, and yet we can control our sort of sense of happiness in some ways too, right? Our sense of fulfillment or gratitude or serenity in some ways.
She's a cup half full kind of woman, I guess, at least, right? As compared to some of the rest of us.
She's what? I'm sorry?
Cup half full. I mean, she is sees.
Oh, yeah.
She ends up with some optimism, some hope in these things, unlike some of us.
Yeah.
She's also pretty young. I was reading her biography. I think she's about 42,
uh-huh.
And went through, as you say, she writes for magazines. I think she wrote for Oprah's magazine, which is a pretty good magazine, actually. But she came from creative writing programs too, I think. So it's I guess in some ways a conventional way to become a poet, isn't it? Or is it?
Well, I should say, I mean, the idea that she's a magazine writer, she's been a freelance magazine writer for a while, and not only does that do a lot better job of paying the bills in poetry, but an MFA program, going to an MFA program as I did, and as, you know, I was an engineer and practiced engineering all my life as well. It's just a really great way of speeding up the learning, right? I mean,
yeah.
One can learn poetry on one's own and whatnot, but you're also, in a way, you're paying for a mentorship and you're paying for someone, you know, to look at your work every single week, to have a class, you know, 5-10 people giving you feedback. So it really accelerates the learning of poetry, and, you know, and it's in a kind of studied a structured program of study, because by the end of an MFA program, you're supposed to write a publishable book of poetry. So it makes you work your butt off, and that's what's really good about it as well, apart from the instruction.
So how do people in a group of 5 to 8 really give you – I've always wondered, they have that writer's program in Boston at Grub Street where a lot of people go that want to do writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's got a great reputation. But I always wonder, if you're sitting around a room with 5 or 6 people and the poem is just not there, I mean – you could crush someone, couldn't you? Or, I mean, do people...
Well, because poets tend to be very sensitive, and we all know we're all very sensitive, there's a whole sort of a lingo that goes around that,
okay.
You know. Unlike critique, like I went to architecture school for a while too, which is just cutthroat, like, this sucks, like, throw it out, like, get out of here, you know. Painting, I have a painter friend, like, critiques in painting are just... I mean, they're just horrible.
Really?
There's no cutting to the bone. But in writing, and I think, there's a lot more of a support. And so there's language that we learn, like you just said, Margie, this poem's not quite there yet. I really like this image. Why don't you think about cutting the last stanza? So we dance around a
little
bit.
Why don't you think about becoming an Uber driver? Right. By the way, you should read our email after every show, Richard. It's not quite so sweet. Okay.
But when you have really good friends later on, I have a trusted group now of 3 or 4 writers, and we do cut through the chase because we're ready. You know, we've been at this for a while. They're like my friend Nikki sometimes says, this needs a construction crew. Get rid of it. Keep this line. And I'm glad for that because I don't want to waste time at this point in my life, you know, dilly-dallying with a poem. And you kind of know inside, too, when something's not right.
I think
and
you do.
So it's great just to get confirmation.
So what's the third poem from your friend?
So, again, you'll see a similar theme here. I think it's called Instructions on Not Giving Up. And she wrote, again, a little blurb. It was a hard winter. My whole body raged against it. But right as the world feels inhabitable, something miraculous happens. The trees come back. I wanted to praise that ordinary thing as a way of bringing myself back to. So we could call this a spring poem. We were not even close to that. Instructions on not giving up. More than the fuchsia fennels breaking out of the crabapple tree, more than the neighbor's almost obscene display of cherry limbs shoving their cotton candy-colored blossoms to the slate sky of spring's rains, it's the greening of the trees that really gets me. when all the shock of white and taffy, the world's baubles and trinkets, leave the pavement strewn with confetti and aftermath, the leaves come, patient, plodding, a green skin growing over whatever winter did to us. A return to the strange idea of continuous living despite the mess of us, the hurt, the empty. Fine then, I'll take it. The green seems to say, a new slick leaf unfurling like a fist to an open palm. I'll take it all. So
I love this one.
Right. So do I.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
You're right. You're right, Jim. There is this half. Well, I think Ada empties the whole cup and then fills it back up.
Well, that's what she does with almost all three that you chose, by the way. There's emptying and then a filling is what it pretty much. By the way, I just want you to know, as you were about to read, I get a click. I get a notice on my phone, and I look at an email I got about a show I did last Thursday. Here's the email from David. It gets back to our, you know, being supportive in your little group. Jim, do you ever think before you speak? I would suggest it might be a good idea sometime. So, as you see, it's a different sort of thing in talk radio and television. I'm sorry to get us off topic.
Oh, no, no, no. Poets might be some of the most generous critiquers in the world.
But, you know, one last question for me, Richard. You know, you said that you often know if the poem isn't quite there, but obviously you're a really skilled poet and you've been at it for a long time. But there are an awful lot of people, I think, who just can't see. You know what I mean? It's like the difference between people who know what they don't know and those who just don't get what they don't know.
But it's not just – you don't mean just in poetry.
Not
you mean
poetry,
in the world.
In the world, yeah, you know?
Well, yeah, and I always draw that analogy that really it is almost like everything in life. You know, there's those people that think they're, you know, they're great backyard football players.
Exactly.
Or whatever. They have no idea. No, I think – but I got to tell you, I mean, but with poetry, it's all, again, just rehearsing and practicing, and it's all just – you know, but still, even myself. There are poems that I'm absolutely in love with, and I have such a blind side to it that I'll share the poem, and they'll be like, "This poem is just really makes no sense," or
yeah.
"You know, this poem is not what you think it is." And so it even catches me by surprise sometimes because it's a constant. We never have a formula for it, right? It's a constant learning process, and if you're not, you know, a healthy sort of guessing. Guessing yourself is really important in art and anything in life, right? Because you're always trying to improve. But yeah, and then sometimes it's hilarious. Sometimes you walk in with a poem that you absolutely hate. You're like into workshop and like this stinks and they're gonna hate it, and the entire class just. It's a masterpiece, and that's because
we haven't had that experience yet here.
That's partly because you took a lot of chances and you feel very uncomfortable because in that particular poem you're writing outside of your comfort zone and something great is happening, and so in your mind you're like this is just stinks, right? So so that also happens.
Okay,
anyway,
we can maybe look forward to that moment for us here in our different sort of, well, I wouldn't call it poetry, whatever it is, banter back and forth. Richard,
this is great,
thank you.
Richard, thank you.
And thank you for introducing us to her because I did not know about Ada Limón, so I'm very excited.
L-I-M-O-N, yeah. If people
L-I-M-O-N,
want to read
yeah.
Work,
yeah. Yeah, it's basically lemon in Spanish, in English.
Limón. Okay.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And sorry about the dog.
Yeah, we really are.
Yeah.
We're doing okay, but yeah, I'm doing okay. And please, what's the name of Ada's book again? The new one?
The Carryings. The Carryings.
So
yeah,
let's put that.
It sounds. It's the Carryings singular. Richard, thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, great.
Richard joins us twice a month for Village Voice. He's the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest project is the fine press book Boundaries, a collaboration with photographer Jacob Pessler. And thank you that we are done for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us 24/7 by way of our podcast at iTunes or at the App Store. Tune in tomorrow for us live at the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library for Jacques Pepin, the ACLU's Carol Rose, and CNN's John King. What's on television, Jim?
We're going to talk more about George W. Bush. We have a bunch of Republicans, actually, on to talk about the Republican Party then, now, and in the future, and some other things as well.
I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Arjun Singh, and our engineer, John the Claw Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in tomorrow or visit us at the library. Have a great afternoon. Bye.